coming to you live from the Never Gillette Studios. This is the soy and almond milk-free paradise called The Mike Church Show.
Something you don't want to do at 6 o'clock in the morning Central Standard Time. You do not want to find yourself watching the 78-year-old socialist wacko on C-SPAN 2. We're going to have a large turnout here in Nevada. The Yeti's going to show up. We're going to find Jimmy Hoffa. And they're going to bring him in here to vote. The caucus for me. And then we're going to win Nevada, Super Tuesday, and then the Democrat nomination. Me calling him Grandpa Stalin does not nearly go far enough. Welcome, it's the Mike Church Show on the Crusade Channel, asking the question of the day.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a Wisdom Wednesday here on the program, and we are loaded up for weak tea sucking commie today. Special guest star Joseph Pierce in hour number two, and of course the one and only brother Andre Marie from the St. Benedict Center for our regular Wisdom Wednesday chat. We've got a lot to chat and talk about today. Let's get the show started. Let me give you the particulars. Telephone number, if you'd like to call the program, 844-527-8723, 844-5-CRUSADE. You can email me directly. My email address is the same as the air was, kingdude, K-I-N-G-D-U-D-E, at mikechurch.com. Official website for all things moi is online at mikechurch.com. Find today's pile of prep, freshly minted, brand new Founding Fathers Red Pill Diary clip is up from yesterday. But you're going to want to stop by the Crusade Channel website and check that out. I put a new item up in the Acting All Crusadery blog, which I have been remiss in updating. And almost a week, but I've got like five items I'm going to put up there today. That's on the front page, crusadechannel.com. And you are, of course, invited to join the Crusader Stadium. That's our free, live, best in the business, best social media that there is chat room at crusadechannel.com/chat. For a change of pace today, we are broadcasting live on Periscope, which basically means it's kind of like the Twitter, one mistake and we'll kill you, Twitter, live stream component. So I think we've done Periscope one time before. This is probably 2-3 years ago. and as I recall, it didn't go over so well. So we're still doing the U-Boob, which we do every day for our Founders Past members. But today, nice free preview for all of you that follow at the King Dude on Twitter and the Veritas Radio Network and Barrett Brief and Mrs. Maggie O'Connell and all of that. So again, if you're on the Twitter, then you could watch the program. Lots to talk about here today. Oh, boy, howdy. Are we loaded up or what? I was sitting here yesterday. I want to continue this string of thought on the proverbial draining of the swamp that we've been hearing about since midsummer 2015. And the Sir Orange the Bad, that's the code name here on the Mike Church Show and on the Crusade Channel for President Trump, because the Never Trumpers, the haters, he's Orange Man Bad. How does he stay orange? Why does he have to be orange? And he's an evil dictator and a racist, too. I love the use of the term racist these days. Can anyone give me a textbook, a definition of what a racist is anymore? You know, the term has been so used and abused and so kicked around with so many tens of millions of different meanings that it has no meaning anymore. He's a racist. Minister Church, you're a racist. Oh, okay. I guess I'm okay with that. You're okay with being an evil. Well, you didn't say evil, dude. You said racist. Yeah, but it's one and the same thing. Okay, can you define that for me again? Well, it's a, and you get the James Carville stutter. Well, it's a, and. So I'm watching Sir Orange the Bad yesterday. I'm trying to, where was he coming from? Yeah, I know he was going to California. Apparently the Olympics are coming back to Los Angeles in 2028. Who cares?
Sorely disappointed with all the poop in the streets.
Well, no, the producer Maggie O'Connor, which you can't see if you're watching this on the Periscope. Now, the poop's not on the streets in L.A. The poop's on the street in San Francisco. Oh, they got poop streets in L.A. too? Apparently, California, there's just poop everywhere. When he was, I know he was headed out to L.A. for some kind of meeting with the 2028 Olympic Committee. Now, they have to let him in on that occasion, right? To say, because I thought Gavin Newsom had basically banned Trump from California. He wasn't allowed to even come in. This is our sanctuary state. You need to keep your orange bad butt out of here. On the tarmac, on the way to Air Force One, I don't know why I'm the only person reporting this and why I'm the only person that's seen this. But Sir Orange the Bad dropped the hammer. He was asked, we'll play you the digital media file later in the broadcast. He was asked by a reporter some question, and then I guess it must have been about Anonymous. And then he said, well, don't you worry, because I know who Anonymous is. And the reporter went, Reggie? You know? Resident Rump wrote who Anonymous is. He said, I know who Anonymous is. Then he said, I also know who the leakers are. And he said, some of them aren't leakers at all. Some of them are media people. Now, I want to take you back, especially if you haven't watched this show or listened to it, and you're catching it for the first time on the Periscope feed, going all the way back to September of last year, when Nazi wine box Nancy the Ripper Pelosi, first made that fateful trip to the briefing room. This president, wax on, wax off. Constitution's going to destroy. All roads lead to Putin. When she started the sham impeachment of her own initiative, and as soon as I began looking into this, and knowing what I already knew about Shifty Adam Schiff, began to, in the news stories that were coming out at the time. Sean Davis writing about it at the Federalist. I was writing about it. I actually discovered the evidentiary chain of the infamous whistle faker's complaint, and then the compromise second draft, because first was rejected. We covered all this stuff, and if you were listening back then you will remember this, of me saying that the whistle faker is either A, it's Schiff, or B, he doesn't actually exist as a person. He's a compendium of leaks that Shifty Schiff put together. Now, another part of this narrative that I want to weave into this, and we're just kind of doing this as a reset to the topic here, is that Donald John Trump is not a lumbering oaf. He's not an idiot. You don't get to his stature in life because you're stupid and because you're an arrogant boob fool that everybody hates and no one wants to work for. You know, I've talked about this before. I won't get into it today. He's got 75,000 employees at Trump International who, by all appearances, save for one or two cranks that were looking for quick lawsuit money, seem to love the guy. You know, you go to any one of those Trump rallies, and who is it that shows up for him? It is not guys that live at, it's not his neighbors at Trump Tower. It's the every dude. It's the guy that goes to a NASCAR race, Daytona, what have you here. this is done through cultivation. You cultivate things. You cultivate relationships. And you also cultivate business relationships. If you want to be successful in business and you don't want to lose your soul and you want to maintain some kind of a conscience, well, then you're a distributist. You want to cultivate relationships, because all of business at the end of the day, unless you're that diabolical, evil archlord villain that runs Amazon known as Jeff Bezos, is relational. And I'm telling you, going all the way back into September now, that Rudy Giuliani has been in Ukraine since November of 2016 or 2017. No, 2016. I had the date right the first time. He was there as the president's private attorney, and he was looking into what Mueller was investigating to see what he could find out about what might have happened in Ukraine. You can, as a matter of fact, you can watch the fruits of Rudy's investigation. He's been putting these videos out the last 4 weeks. They're called Common Sense. You can watch them on YouTube. It's up to episode number 8. For extra credit, watch my video series that I'm working with the French journalist on, called Ukraine Gate. Go to Ukraine Gate. Just spell it out, ukrainegate.info. So the idea that the first time Don John of Manhattan, that's my nickname for the president, the fourth Don John, that Don John of Manhattan for the first time heard about corruption in Ukraine and then went, ooh, corruption in Ukraine, I can go after the Bidens. And as Sylvia the Sea Hag Garcia said in her character assassination of the president during the sham impeachment trial, that the first time he heard about it was in May of 2019 is just a laughable joke. That's just a joke. Because Giuliani had been there for 2 years, compiling evidence, interviewing witnesses and what have you here. Now, why am I telling you all this? Because when I play the digital media files, I like to give you the backstory so that you know what's going on. And I'm going to hit you guys with, if you're a new listener, and welcome to those that signed up last week in our great $1 a week membership drive. It was a great success last week. You probably have never heard this before. What if Don John of Manhattan knew half the deep state planet was listening to the Zelensky call? Have you ever thought of that? What if he knew? Well, you should have thought of it, because the president has said it a half a dozen times. He said, do you not think that I knew that all of these people were listening to the call? I know how a call goes. I'm not stupid. Yesterday, we got a nugget that supports the King Dude theory. And the Gregory Junk Bond Carpenter, author of Reverse Deception, the book, and Reverse Deception Radio Theory, the radio show. What if the Ukraine call was made for two reasons? Now, remember, the guy that wrote The Art of the Deal, he's not a bumbling, fumbling oaf idiot. He knows what he's doing. He already knows from Giuliani that, that most people, politicians in Ukraine are corrupt. He already knows about Burisma, and he already knows about Viktor Shokin, the prosecutor. Son of a bitch, they fired the guy. He knows all this. This is not news to him. He knows all of this. He also knows that Volodymyr Zelensky, the new president, was elected on a reform platform. Now, if you're a smart business guy and you're shrewd, Trump is, wouldn't you want to find out whether or not Zelensky's peeps were lying to you when they were telling you through all of these St. Maria Yovanovitch, Ambassador Yovanovitch, through all of these holy deep state people that Schiff dragged into that meeting? Can you tell me what did he? Well, I can tell you that Ukrainians loved us. They loved us before Sir Orange the Bad. Now they hate us. Wouldn't you want to know whether or not, before you gave Javelin missiles and $500 million in free money, would you want to know if it was going for the purposes that Congress appropriated it for? Wouldn't you want to know whether or not it was going into a corrupt establishment or government, or was going into a clean one? I would. Seems to me that that's kind of presidential duty stuff there, right? D-U-T-Y. I caught it. They were saying, Mr. Chart, please, you said duty. Not San Francisco duty. Honor and duty. So he knows all this going into the call. He knows they're listening. He lays the egg out there, but he also gives Zelensky a chance to redeem himself and make a friend. Not redeem himself, to make a friend and a confidant in Trump, or to show that he's corrupt. So what does he do? He lays out what he knows. Hey, could you look into this whole Biden thing? I hear there's some terrible, from what I hear, this corruption is horrible. Zelensky now has the rope to hang himself. If he's on the take, and if he is a Poroshenko, the previous corrupt president, then he's going to run back and he's going to tell the corrupt Ukrainian oligarch gang, we got a problem. Sir Orange the Bad is on to us, and they're on to Biden, the grifter, the real grifter. If he's not on the take, he doesn't even know what Trump's talking about. He's got to ask, what is this? I know a little bit about this Burisma thing. You got to remember, Zelensky was a TV comedian before he was elected president. So what's Trump done? Two things. Number one, he's told the deep state, I know a little bit about Biden, and I know about this corruption, you idiots. I'm not as stupid as you think. Are you listening to the call? Start your rumor mill. And he's also trying to find out whether or not he can trust Zelensky, which ultimately he finds out that he can. Smart move, right? Because if Zelensky comes back and says anything other than, yeah, we got guys that are looking into the whole Biden-Burisma thing, and by the by, did you know that there has been a criminal complaint now filed against Hunter Biden in Ukraine? It was fired by, son of a bitch, Viktor Shokin. Shokin strikes back. He's a prosecutor again. What is Papa Biden going to do about that? I'll tell you what he's going to do. He's not going to get the Democrat nomination. And that's not the only reason, but that's the principal reason. Fast forward a week after the phone call, before the whistle faker. Now, the whistle faker is listening and trying to hear things. One of the moles is then told, hey, we hear that the president is holding back on the Ukraine aid to try to get him, to try to get Zelensky to look in to Biden. Scuttlebutt in the White House hallways, right? This is planted. This is bait to see if Schiff will take it. Not only does Schiff take it, he takes it and he runs with it. He's like, if you don't live in Southeast Louisiana, this will make absolutely no sense to you. But he's like a speckled trout. Speckled trout, when it's got live bait, if you ever fish for speckled trout with a live cockahoe minnow on a line, the speckled trout, especially if it's a mother, will swim up to it like, oh, shrimp, dinner. But wait a minute. I'm going to make sure it's dead first. And she'll go right towards it, turn at the last second, and swat the shrimp with her tail, and it knocks the shrimp out, and then she swallows it whole. And that's when you set your hook. The whistle faker, the plant, was in the White House. Schiff walked up to it, swatted it, went, oh, I'm taking this one, and then took the bait. Hook, line, and sinker. This is why he had to make up the transcript of the phone after Trump released the transcript. Remember the famous, and don't you call me, I'll call you, the whole thing, you know, the whole fake transcript. Now we have the missing piece of the puzzle. Ms. O'Connell, can you queue up digital media file number Sir Orange the Bad? I don't have a sheet today, do I? So that's digital media file number one. Two things that you're listening for here today. One, who's anonymous? Well, anonymous is one of the guys in the White House that corroborates the whistle faker story. Very important. Now, what did I just... I just gave you the precursor so you can understand what's going on in Sir Orange the Good's mind here. When he says, and we know that whistle fakers are not whistle fakers, that they're media guys. And other people. Who do you think the other people are? People that work for Shifty Schiff. Now the whole narrative that I just told you that, because you got to remember, the Trump White House has been a leaking sieve since it started. Much to the president's chagrin. And all this is done to do what? Destroy the president. Yeah, one. Protect the deep state. Don't drain the swamp. Now, hearing all of that narrative, this now will all make sense in a whole new light that you never heard before this morning. Here's Trump yesterday confirming some of what I just told you.
Going two. All right. Okay. So I'll see you maybe in the plane. How are you? Marriage is good? Huh?
One other thing. Is there a search underway for Anonymous? Remember Anonymous?
Yeah, there is. It's not so much a search. I know who it is.
Who is it?
Can't tell you that.
Why not?
But I know who it is.
We won't get into it.
People know it's a fraud. I know who it is, and I know who some of the leakers are. But some of the leakers don't exist. It's made up by the press. So, you know, they say 9 people have said, or 2 people have said, and those people don't exist. But no, I know all about Anonymous. I know a lot about the leakers, too. We know a lot. In fact, when I want to get something out to the press, I tell certain people, and it's amazing. It gets out there. But so far, I'm leaving it that way. I'll see you later. Thank you. See you on the plane.
Troll. That's a troll. That's a world-class troll. Why didn't I read about that? That just happened yesterday. Why wasn't that headline news at the Atlantic? Why isn't the Washington Compost all over that? Why aren't major news organizations going, uh-oh, we got a problem? Two things that I want you to, that you just heard. Number one, now the reporter said, wait, you're still looking into, you're searching for Anonymous. We're not searching for anything, pal. We know who Anonymous is. Ruh-roh. Major. That's epic trolling there. Now, what if you're Anonymous, Mr. Barrett? You and I talked about this last night. If you're Anonymous and you heard that, what did you do yesterday afternoon?
Well, there's a couple things that you could do. The first thing is that... You, sorry about that. Hold on. Caught me off guard here. What, first thing is you shore up your exit strategy, if you need to get out real quick, or you start to get a little hot under the collar and you start cozying up to the president like, hey, Mr. President, do you like your coffee
hey,
a little
Donnie,
bit different?
How you
like, yeah. You want a bagel this morning or anything like that?
Mr. President, I know you like, lox on your bagel because Ivanka's married to the Jewish guy. Would you like some lox?
Look at these brand new golf clubs I got. Somebody just dropped them off at my house. Would you like them? I know you like golf or something like that.
So what he's basically saying, what we're talking about here is apparently Anonymous is still in the West Wing. Clue number two, when I want to get something out to the press, I know who to go tell it to. And he could have pulled a Biden and gone, I just go walk down the hall and give it to this guy and son of a bitch. Son of a bitch. They printed the story and it was a good story. Knows who Anonymous is. He knows he's got leaks. And I know some of the leakers. Now, note some of the leakers. I take Trump at his word. You know, people think he's a big oaf, lumbering idiot, manipulating liar. I don't take him as a liar at all. I take him as some of this stuff is obviously trolling.
He doesn't say things out in public unless he is 100%. He knows he is correct.
I want to take you back to October the 3rd, 2019, as we continue this thrilling monologue here today. Too bad we don't have a great crowd in the chat room, crusadechannel.com/chat. Struggling to get up to 20 members in there today. Come on, guys. Wisdom Wednesday. In any event, take you back to October the 3rd. Famous confrontation by the Weinbach Nancy Media Industrial Complex. All waiting for him as he walked out of the White House to go to Marine One. And we're screaming at him, what are you going to do? Nancy's got you. What are you going to do? Wait, why did you say this about Mr. Biden? Why did Joe Biden's one of our heroes? You can't say that about him. And what does Don John of Manhattan do? He trolls him again. What does he say? Famously, the Bidens are corrupt. I know they're corrupt. Now, again, art of the deal. Guy's not an idiot. Donald John Trump knows how to work the press, knows how to work television, and knows how to set this stuff up. Why would he go out 1 week after he's been impeached, or they're talking about impeaching him, and say, when he should have been going, hey, I never said anything about the Bidens. He doesn't lie. Now, folks, this is what you got to know about this. The president knew all about Burisma and all about Little Hunter and Devin Archer and Papa Joe, son of a bitch, long before the July 25th call. Knew all about it. Was totally briefed by his lawyer and by others, actual White House attorney and counsel. Totally knew it. Everything, he knew all of it. When he goes out that tarmac on October the 3rd and says the Bidens are corrupt, it's not because he's fishing, not because, you know, that he thinks or he's heard a rumor, because his friend and his lawyer, Giuliani, has told him, I got the goods, Mr. President. You can say they're corrupt because they are, and I can prove it. This stuff is not hard to figure out. People are adding all these twists and turns to it, and there is some twist and turn here to it. So three things here have happened. One, the deep state is in utter panic mode right now. Now that Attorney General Barr's gotten involved in this, they are in full-blown hit. If we're cockroaches, the light just came on. Get underneath the baseboard. Panic. Two, you didn't see this, and we don't know exactly what, but the president trolled his enemies yesterday. That was a troll. He's an expert in trolling. But that was a troll yesterday. That was here. Let's play Texas Hold'em. I got these two cards up here. Oh, look, Deep State. That's an ace and that's a king. Same suit too. What do you have? Oh, you got a two and a four. Great. That was an epic troll yesterday. When you find out, and you will, Joy Pullman wrote about this yesterday. Here, let me take it back to yesterday. Mike Churchill here on the Crusade Channel, last live radio station standing, always on air and always online at crusadechannel.com. I wanted to hit that story here today. We're streaming live on the Periscope here today as well, so welcoming all of you in. Hope you are in enjoying the program. You know, of course, because I'm looking for it, I cannot find the Joy Pullman story from yesterday. And I only have 425,000 pieces of paper here. Well, I can paraphrase what she said. And that is, the deep state, the swamp will begin to drain when the bureaucracy has been slashed and is burning in front of us. When the permanent state bureaucracy has been slashed and is burning in front of us. Trump's problem from the beginning is he's too trusting. He didn't fire all of Obama's henchmen. He should have fired every single one of them. Should have totally just completely gutted the State Department, but he didn't do it. Well, we're going to find out all of this. And boy, howdy, is it going to be fun to watch Shifty Adam Schiff and others, Jim Baker, perp walked in straitjackets with an FBI agent or whoever on either arm with Schiff going, they're going to take me to federal jail. Oh, you're not going to federal jail, but you're going under the federal jail. By the by, hey, Adam, ever heard of Jeffrey Epstein? Might want to keep that name in mind. 844-527-8723 is our call in line telephone number, 844-5-CRUSADE. Once the whole truth has finally come out, here's what Joy Pullman wrote yesterday. Congress needs to be thinking about how they're going to make sure this never happens again. They will not do that by making the Department of Injustice even less accountable to elected officials, as Democrats are demanding. They will do it by slashing and burning the bureaucracy. Amen. Can I get an amen, sister? They will do it by slashing and burning the bureaucracy and its powers. Government by and for the people will perish from the earth. She's quoting Lincoln there. If unelected officials are capable of weaponizing government against the people's elected representatives, that's what a banana republic really is. And we don't want to live in a banana republic here. Amen, sister. This portion of the program here today on a Wisdom Wednesday brought to you by our friends at Bulldog Kia in Athens, Georgia. I bought all my cars the last 9 years from my friends at Bulldog Kia. Why? Because the Kernall family is a family business that I trust and I can rely on. I'm driving now my 8-year-old 2012 Kia Sorento, and she's just a humming along at 128,000 miles. Ain't it a thing of beauty? Kia Automobile, some of the finest cars made out there. Mitt is O'Connell is driving a brand new 2019 Kia Sportage. We are a Kia Bulldog Kia family here. I hope you will consider becoming a Bulldog Kia family member as well. Look them up on the internet at bulldogkia.com. And if you got any questions about the car, or if you want to talk to someone there about financing or about their VIP delivery service, which is available to you because you know me, give them a call, 855-BULL-DOG. That's 855-BULL-DOG. But you'll find everything you need to know and all the cars that are on sale, including pre-owned, certified used Kias at bulldogkia.com. We'll see you at Bulldog Kia You tell him the King Dude sent you by. All right, what else? Oh, wait a minute. So that's my deep state recap for the day. We seem to be doing one every day because the story's advancing. When is the media industrial complex going to start reporting this? This is an outrage. This is a straight up, if I can figure this out, why can't Eric Risen at the New York New Tenochtitlan Times? Why can't he figure it out? If I can figure this out, where's that hag hack? What's her name at the Washington Compost? The one that Mrs. O'Connell's asked me, is she real? Oh, gosh, the conservative, the never Trump conservative. What's that hag's name? Jennifer Rubin. Where's Jennifer Rubin on this? Why is it Jennifer Rubin writing about this? So this morning we're sitting here, we're minding our own business, drinking our coffee and going down our show prep and getting ready for the program. And we do a sound check every morning. Well, usually I'll just fire up the mixing console to my, you can't see it here, but it's to my left. And I'll run some audio from C-SPAN through it, or usually C-SPAN. And then we'll check our levels and make sure everything in the chain is working correctly. Well, this morning when I fired it up, I got Grandpa Stalin. And it was a Three Stooges shock moment for everyone in the studio. Me, Mrs. O'Connell, and Mr. Mitter Barrett all went, Hey, Mo! Hey, Larry! Where'd the commie come from? So I'm listening to this guy going like, oh, good Lord. Can you imagine that together we're all going to have to suffer an entire presidential campaign with that guy as the nominee, Democrat nominee? Now, you and I know he can't be the Democrat nominee. He can't be. Apparently, they have not told him.
Just
listen.
Go.
Bernie rally in Nevada.
We are going to end the current border policy under our administration. Federal agents will not be snatching babies from the arms of their mothers.
Stop the digital media. But doctors from druids from Planned Parenthood will be snatching babies from the wombs of their mother. Right, Bern?
And under our administration, we will do what the American people want us to do, pass comprehensive immigration reform and a path toward citizenship for the 11 million undocumented.
Bring them all in. Hey, why give them a path? Just legalize them.
I know that Nevada...
I know that Nevada...
And not only Nevada, but Nevada has seen some horrible, horrible gun violence and mass killings. I know that. And here is my promise to you. Our gun policy, our gun safety policy, will be determined by the American people, not the NRA.
Hey, D-bag, the American people are the NRA.
And that means we will have... universal background checks. People with violent past should not be owning guns.
We're
going to end the gun show loophole. We're going to end the straw man provision. We're going to do what the American people want us to do right now, is that is to end the sale and distribution of assault weapons in this country.
Okay, now this, bring Mr. Barrett in here. This is a complete and absolute canard because no one can define what an assault weapon is.
It's all based on how scary it looks. Whether
stop! That's an assault weapon. Actually, dude, that's a souped-up Super Circle squirt gun.
There's no way. Plus,
one fires water, actually.
But
it looks scary. I'm soy. It looks scary.
It really is all based on how scary it looks. Whether the stock folds or if it doesn't fold or if it has an optic on it or any of these things. Yeah, these people don't understand. And all you have to do is listen to the guys in Virginia, the Democratic lawmakers at the state level in Virginia, try to describe why the things that were in their bill actually made sense. And it's Oh, I don't want to. I don't want anybody to ever hear the clip because you'll get dumber from hearing it. But there is no gun show loophole. Universal background checks do not work. They never have worked, and I've talked about it on the program because how are you going to enforce it? You can have universal background checks. That's great, but unless you have a police officer in every
single home. How do you know that
home,
the weirdo that's at the store buying a gun is an incel?
Yeah. How are you going to? You can't enforce it.
Is there an incel blood test? No.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. It's called your search history, essentially, at that point. So.
So. This whole thing, now this gets all these this and the people the young men that are at Bernie rallies are incels. Minister Church, please, what's an incel? You don't want to know, dude. Involuntary celibate. How they get in? How do you become involuntary celibate? Digest a lot of porn and do what comes unfortunately naturally after you've done so. That's how you become involuntary celibate. We won't talk about this today, but on a future show and many past shows, if you're watching this on Periscope today with our free preview of the Mike Church Show, welcome aboard. We've done a lot of shows on banning porn. And we don't need any new laws to do it. Restore the old obscenity laws. Tell the states to start. I'll tell my state of Louisiana, start enforcing the obscenity laws. Well, how am I? And of course they're going to say, well, how are we going to do that in an internet age? Find the way. First of all, no PDAs. No. You got to completely lock it out of public. That means it is an act of obscenity for you, fair incel, metrosexual, skinny jean, impotent loser. It is an act of obscenity you can be arrested, tried, and convicted for you to be sitting there on your stupid little smart device, or dumb device in your case, and streaming porn while you're in a public place. That will get you thrown in the clink. Nice, easy thing to do. Doesn't it? You want people spying? If he's doing it in public and there are children around, yeah. If that's what it takes, yeah, call him a spy. Who cares? Now, you haven't heard the best from Grandpa Stalin. Oh, listen to this.
So, here we are at a pivotal moment in American history.
Say that again.
Here we are,
Gramps,
in Nevada, where there will be a caucus on Saturday
at noon,
where there is early voting, which will end today. So my plea to all of you, and I'm happy to take a little walk with you over to the polling place.
Imagine that. Grandpa walking the grandkids over to the polling place.
And that is, let us have in this Nevada caucus, let us have the largest turnout that the Nevada caucus has ever seen. All right. Now, our young generation, let me say this to the young people here. You are the most progressive young generation in the history of this country.
That means you're the most stupid, gullible.
Your generation is more anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-homophobia, anti-religious bigotry, anti-xenophobia than any generation in American history.
Can you tell me something that they're for?
And you should be proud of that.
Yay.
That's the good news. Here's the bad news. The bad news is, although we're seeing good changes in this, the bad news is that young people still do not vote in the kinds of numbers they should be voting.
Numbers. It's all about numbers.
If young people under 29, for example, voted at the same rate as people 65 or older, we would transform this country.
Heaven forfend.
So my plea to you is that, you know, we won the Iowa caucus, won the popular vote there. We won the New Hampshire primary. And if there is a large voter turnout here in Nevada, I believe we're going to win the caucus here.
We're going to win. Now, listen, here it comes.
And if we win the caucus here, we're going to do really well in South Carolina, California, and on Super Tuesday.
And then?
And if we do well on Super Tuesday, we're going to win the Democratic nomination.
And then?
And then, Grandpa!
And if we win the Democratic nomination, we will defeat Donald Trump.
Yeah! Kill babies!
All right, enough of that. Little snippet there from The Burn. Now, apparently, he doesn't know, or he hasn't been told, the DNC, the Democrats, they're not giving you their nomination, dude. You're not getting it. Again, people do not ever think that there's anything that the Democrat Party is incapable of doing when it comes to evil, because there is nothing. Here's what the Democrat Party is incapable of doing.
0.0.
It'll come down to the convention. It'll be Sanders. Biden, I'm telling you, Biden is toast. Ukraine gate's going to sink him if it hadn't already sunk. That in his big mouth. And he does what Joe Biden does. Fifth time the guy's run for president. Five times. And he always sinks himself. He is a self-sinking, rotten candidate. The only thing he could ever get elected to was in the second smallest state in the entire union to become a senator from Delaware. Then he didn't even live there. He was commuting from Scranton, Pennsylvania, because he knew Delaware was ripe for picking.
He says things like lying dog-faced pony soldier.
That's what I'm saying. Everyone loves Silky Joe. He's the guy that helps you out at the hardware store. No, he's not. He's the guy that walks up to the hardware store and goes, "Hey, Bob, you don't know how to use that hammer. Get out of the way. Give me that hammer. Let me show you how to use it." Stupid idiot dog pony. Whatever. Hillary rides in on her broomstick, Maleficent One, during the DNC. Does the 1968 Democrat convention. Now, just imagine that outside the Democrat convention are those lunatics that you just heard at the Bernie Sanders rally, pissed off because their guy had the nomination stolen from them. People forget what happened outside the DNC in 1968 in Chicago. There were riots. There were riots. People were killed. It's coming again. As the destruction. You can't flirt with the kind of evil. Infanticide, mutilating 5-year-old children as policy. You can't just be flirting with that kind of evil and not have it affect your thought process and ultimately bring your sick, sorry butt to perdition. Meaning you either change your way or, oh, gee, I don't want to be there when you get struck. 844-527-8723, our call-in line telephone number. Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel. Did you know that the Babadook Buttigieg is not gay enough? Where's Big Gay Al when we need him? You remember Big Gay Al from South Park? I'm super. Thanks for asking. Is it in the pile, the not gay enough? Let's see. Oh, here we go. Gays who hate Pete Buttigieg. Is there such a thing? Oh, you have no idea. Rod Dreher. I'm on my way this morning to Bucknell University in Pennsylvania, where I'm scheduled to appear with my friend Andrew Sullivan tonight to talk about religion, identity, and culture. Why is an Eastern Orthodox going to be teaming up with an atheist to talk religion? It's why we have to have Wisdom Wednesday. This doesn't even make common sense. And then he's got an ad here for this. Blah, blah, blah. One thing I hope Andrew and I get to talk about tonight is the bizarre rejection of Pete Buttigieg by the homo left. Homosexual writer, radical nutbag lesbian, Masha Gessen of The New Yorker explains the Pete hate. Turns out that Buttigieg is what's called a normie. Now, this is not Norm from Cheers, and you sure don't want to be having a beer with it. He's a normie. Did you know that? You know, I'm just thinking of the Saturday Night Live sketch. Will Smith has been chosen to play the father, Serena and Vanessa Williams. Can he play that? He absolutely cannot play that. He's not black enough. Ding, 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 ding. You are right, Jackie. Pete Buttigieg has been chosen to be the homosexual nominee for the Democrat Party in 2020, but can he play that? Ding, 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 ding. No, he absolutely cannot play that. He is not anarcho-homosexual enough. You are right, Masha. Masha Gessen. The other, more mainstream and more often visible kind of LGBT politics aims to erase difference. Its message to straight people is, we're just like you. And all we want is the right to have what you have. Marriage. Chirons, a place, a house with a picket fence, and the right to serve in the military. The vision of this politics is a society in all respects indistinguishable from the one in which we live now. Except queer people have successfully and permanently blended in. To be sure, all kinds of queer people have been involved in both kinds of queer politics. I love how she can just use the Q word. Young man, did you say the Q word? But the politics of being just like you leaves out the people who cannot or do not want to be just like conventional straight people, whether in appearance or in the way we connect our lives and families. What makes Buttigieg an easy and reassuring choice for those older white straight people and a disturbing possibility for the queer people who seem to be criticizing him for not being gay enough? It is that he is profoundly, essentially conservative. He is an old politician in a young man's body, a straight politician in a gay man's body. Well, first of all, there is no such thing. There's just a body. You're either male or you're female. And if you have homosexual tendencies, that's a disordered thinking. It's something that no one should ever be told to act upon. Same way that if your daughter grows up and has disordered thinking and wants to be a promiscuous tramp, you don't send her out and say, hey, I got an idea. Why don't you come out as a slut? And why don't you ride the bus home tonight with the football team? You know, when you put this into proper perspective, this insanity that is presented as sanity makes no sense, does it? Well, wait a minute. Let me tell you where Masha Gessen is coming from. I just happen to have a digital media file from 2014. This was at a lesbian, angry, radical, wacko, nutbag lesbian conference in Sydney, Australia. Here's what Miss Gessen really wants to tell the Babadook to do. Listen.
I agree. It's a no-brainer that we should have the right to marry. But I also think equally that it's a no-brainer that the institution of marriage should not exist. So,
yay! Let's vote for no marriage! Yay!
That causes my brain some trouble.
Does it?
And part of it, why it causes me trouble, is because fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we're going to do with marriage when we get there. You know, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change. And that is a lie. The institution of marriage is going to change, and it should change. And again, I don't think it should exist.
Not your call to make, sweetheart.
I don't like taking part in creating fictions about my life. That's sort of not what I had in mind when I came out 30 years ago.
Now, wait a minute. You're probably going like, I never heard this before, Mike. Of course you haven't. Citizen, you will obey your mainstream media overlord. You're not supposed to hear this. You're not supposed to know these radicals are out there. And you're not supposed to know what the real sodomite agenda is. Because that's it. It never was about acceptance. It never was about, we just want to have what you have. And just, we're going to be a gay body. That we. They want the obliteration. Question, fair listener. What creature is it that wishes the obliteration of men? Starts with an S. Ends with an N. 5 seconds, Satan. Satan! Right. You haven't heard what this did. Now you go like, you're being so mean, and you're such a homophobe, and this and that and the other. Disordered thinking. Dystopian disordered thinking leads and can only produce more dystopian thinking. Should we throw some incest into all this? Again, you're not supposed to know that this happened.
You know, I have three kids who have five parents, more or less. and I don't see why they shouldn't have five parents legally. I don't see why we should choose two of those parents and make them into a sanctioned couple. And because between those five parents, we have two groups with two different citizenships.
You might
two
need
groups
to
of three.
You might need to take us through that. You might need to take us through that because we're getting a bit confused.
It would take
a long
time. No, I have...
Listen.
Well,
you got married in Massachusetts?
I got married in Massachusetts to my partner, who's Russian, my ex-partner. And by that time, we had two kids. One of whom was adopted and one of whom I gave birth to. We broke up a couple of years after that. And a couple of years after that, I met my new partner. And she has just had a baby. And that baby's biological father is my brother.
All right, enough of this lunatic. That baby's biological father is my brother. That's 6 years ago. That's 2014. Oh, but don't worry. Better chart, please. Anyone can cherry pick. New Tenoch Tietlin Times, right here. The Babadook, Buttigieg, he's not gay enough. Mike Churchill here on the Crusade Channel, the last live radio station standing, always on air and always online at crusadechannel.com. Foundations restored. Get your 17 DVD or streaming video series today. Don't pass this one up. It's a game changer. Go to crusadechannel.com/Adam. Crusade Channel, last live radio station standing.
Okay, yes. We are bored. We're all bored now. But has it ever occurred to you, Wally, that the process that creates this boredom that we see in the world now may very well be a self-perpetuating, unconscious form of brainwashing created by a world totalitarian government based on money, and that all of this is much more dangerous than one thinks? And it's not just a question of individual survival, Wally, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and somebody who's asleep will not say no? See, I keep meeting these people. I mean, just a few days ago, I met this man whom I greatly admire. He's a Swedish physicist, Gustav Bjornstrand. And he told me that he no longer watches television, he doesn't read newspapers, and he doesn't read magazines. He's completely cut them out of his life because he really does feel that we're living in some kind of Orwellian nightmare now, and that everything that you hear now contributes to turning you into a robot. And when I was at Findhorn, I met this extraordinary English tree expert who had devoted his life to saving trees. Just got back from Washington, lobbying to save the redwoods. He's 84 years old, and he always travels with a backpack because he never knows where he's going to be tomorrow. And when I met him at Findhorn, he said to me, "Where are you from?" And I said, "New York." He said, "Ah, New York, yes, that's a very interesting place. Do you know a lot of New Yorkers who keep talking about the fact that they want to leave but never do?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And he said, "Why do you think they don't leave?" I gave him different banal theories. He said, "Oh, I don't think it's that way at all." He said, "I think that New York is the new model for the new concentration camp, where the camp has been built by the inmates themselves, and the inmates are the guards, and they have this pride in this thing they've built. They've built their own prison, and so they exist in a state of schizophrenia, where they are both guards and prisoners, and as a result, they no longer have, having been lobotomized, the capacity to leave the prison they've made or to even see it. as a prison. And then he went into his pocket and he took out a seed for a tree and he said, this is a pine tree. He put it in my hand and he said, escape before it's too late. See, actually, for 2 or 3 years now, Chiquita and I have had this very unpleasant feeling that we really should get out. That we really should feel like Jews in Germany in the late 30s. Get out of here. Of course, the problem is where to go, because it seems quite obvious that the whole world is going in the same direction. See, I think it's quite possible that the 1960s represented the last burst of the human being before he was extinguished. And that this is the beginning of the rest of the future now. That from now on, there'll simply be all these robots walking around, feeling nothing, thinking nothing. And there'll be nobody left almost to remind them that there once was a species called a human being, with feelings and thoughts. And that history and memory are right now being erased. And soon, nobody will really remember that life existed on the planet.
Maggie O'Connell is the Mike Church Show's producer, and she used to be a people person. But people cured her of that.
Edition of the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, last live radio station standing, always on air, always online, the CrusadeChannel.com. Our live Crusade Stadium, Crusader Stadium chat room is open at CrusadeChannel.com/chat, if you'd like to pop on in there and experience real social media. You know, I was asking yesterday for people that are new listeners, and I was looking at the membership statistics. And there has been in the last month, because some people are cashing in now, or cashed in, their gift memberships that they got for Christmas that some of you sent them. Add to that the 25 or so that took advantage of the $1 a week sale on Founders Pass memberships, and you've got you're over halfway to 100 should be new listeners. That's potential members in the chat room. Now, if we did a little algorithm and calculated this and that, we say that about 6-7% of people that are Founders Pass members actually use the chat rooms. Less than 10%. It's not even the double digits. So you would still then expect that there might be 5 or 6 new chatters that have somehow wandered into CrusadeChannel.com/chat. To our knowledge, there have been, we're on the fence if it's 1 or 2. So this is a cordial invite to you, if you're that guy or gal that is now listening to Crusade Channel radio station and stream. And since if they're not listening, they can't hear because the preview stream is is playing previews to get people to subscribe at CrusadeChannel.com/go. I'm only communicating them with people that are new listeners. So just know that you're welcome to come on in, check out the live chat room again, CrusadeChannel.com/chat. Do not be alarmed if the chat descends into conspiratorial chaos from time to time. It happens. But you'd have to actually be there to experience that. And since there's no controversy and post-shampeachment, the activity on all media has now kind of gone back to normal, which, by the by, is living is proof live broadcasting works. No one wanted to listen to the Sea Hag. Oh, no one wanted to listen to the Sea Hag anyway. No one wanted to listen to any of the proceedings of the shampeachment of Donald John Trump as a podcast. They wanted to experience it live. So, just know, and I've made this announcement before, I'm going to reiterate it, and I'm going to keep doing it every day. When the campaign actually does get started, and there are daily campaign stops, rallies and what have you, just know that we will cover every single one of them where the audio is available. I can't always get audio if I can't get it from now, C-SPAN does a pretty good job of covering it, but until Grandpa Stalin is actually coronated as the king of the Socialist Democrat Party, they're covering everybody's campaign right now. So it's hard to get clean audio. Although usually the president tends to go places at night. So I think, you know, what is this? The Nevada caucus is Saturday, right? And South Carolina's next Tuesday. Because he said he would be in South Carolina Monday, I believe. So if the audio is there, we will broadcast it right here on the Crusade Channel. Last live radio station standing. February 22nd. Is South Carolina or Nevada? That's Nevada. He's not going to Nevada. There's no reason for him to. Unless he wants to go visit his casino. Go check in on Don Jr. And South Carolina is the 25th. So it is hunk of letter, 23, Tuesday. So next Tuesday will be South Carolina primary. And that supposedly is where Silky Joe Biden will be making his last stand. Let's go to the Dude Maker Hotline. Been talking about this all day. By the by, today is a mini Joseph Pierce book fair because we don't have stock of all the books. What's the deal? You buy two and get what? 25% off. So today's a great day to stock up on Master Pierce, Brigadier General, Field Marshal, Master Pierce, the Baron of the Bard, as he has been proclaimed today. Books, MikeChurch.com/shop. If you put two Pierce books in your cart, and there are a lot of good ones in there, and they're all signed and dated by Joseph, the cart will automatically adjust to give you 25% off. Too bad Joe and Joe on here. What I got to do? I got to go knock on your door? I mean, come on there. That's a great deal, even for Jersey boys. All right, to the Dude Maker Hotline for Mr. Pierce here on a, isn't it appropriate that we would bring Joseph in on a Wisdom Wednesday? Mr. Pierce, impart some wisdom to us.
Well, you put me on the spot there. I was sort of waiting patiently for you to pass some wisdom to you. Okay, I've just written something for the Imaginist Conservative entitled Making the World Safe for Democracy? The article basically is about the fact that war does not make the world safe for democracy, contrary to Woodrow Wilson's claim to the contrary. And I just written about, First World War make the world safe for democracy? No, it didn't. Did the Second World War? No, it didn't. Did the wars in the Middle East? No, they didn't. So, that's what I've been writing this morning. I actually finished that before you phoned, so I've got an early start today.
Hey, fantastic. I just heard my buddy the Rooster.
You did? He's out there. In fact, there's three of them out there now. I get a lot of fun watching them fight each other all day. Basically, I get any work done, really.
You know that while you're mentioning that fighting wars makes the world safe for democracy, as they say, Tom Selleck, the actor, played Ike in a TV miniseries called Ike. And on the day before the Normandy invasion, when he was giving the rah-rah speech to the guys who were going to go on the beaches and get cut to pieces by German machine gun fire,
He gave the reasons why we're doing this. We're taking Europe back from the Nazis to make the world safe for democracy. He actually said that in the movie. So, now, I don't know
obviously, getting rid of the Nazis was a good thing, but handing over the whole of Eastern Europe to the communists wasn't particularly good, and that was the immediate consequence of the victory of World War II. So, hardly made the world safe for democracy. Whatever other good things, such as the defeat of the Nazis, that might have arose from D-Day, did not make the world safe for democracy.
Right, and the fact that, of course, the term democracy, it doesn't mean what people in 21st century America think that it means. They think that, well, okay, what's democracy? Well, that's what freedom is. Oh, you mean freedom to abort babies and to every other licentious behavior that one can imagine. That's not, democracy doesn't do that. You know, a democracy by classic definition is simply 50% of the population plus one gets their way. It's an absolutely awful way to run a civilization, isn't it?
Well, let me say one thing there. I'm not disagreeing with you, but I am distinguishing and making a distinguo as people should. Again, it depends how we're defining the term. The term democracy, as you just used it, is the sort of way that it's used by Plato in the Republic, that basically that democracy descends very quickly into mob rule. Mob rule results in anarchy, and the consequence of anarchy is the survival of the most tyrannous and the strongest, which means that basically that democracy leads via anarchy to tyranny. So it's not a stable form of government. That's the Platonic understanding of democracy, and that's what you've just given, basically, mob rule, and I agree with you completely. But if democracy does mean that we have some form of genuine subsidiarity in the sense that people should have some real political power over their own lives and the land on which they live and their property, etc., and some say in the government that's ruling over them, then if that's what we mean by democracy, then obviously that's good. But the point is that democracy in that sense only works at the local level. Once government gets further and further away from the people, it becomes less and less democratic. So we're living now in a macro democracy, which is not democratic. But the federal government's miles away from the ordinary people and heedless of their wishes, where the European Union rides roughshod over the will and wishes of the peoples and the nations of Europe, etc., etc. So you can fly the flag of democracy without actually practicing it. I'm talking about it now in the good sense that I've just used it.
So, just to wrap that subject up, you sounded almost distributist in the first instance.
Heaven forbid that I should ever sound distributist.
I know, like, and that's a four-letter word to many people.
I know. Yeah, it's a four-letter word because they can only get as far as D-I-S-T and they can't spell the rest of it.
Well, and they go, oh, you and Pierce and you weirdos, you're distributist, you're socialist, you want to confiscate all the land and give it away in 3 cows and 3 acres. I'm like, man, well, I don't know who started that rumor, because I wish I could find the guy so I could, I can't say I would kill him. I wish I could find the guy so I could
correct him. Fraternal correction.
Yes, to correct a guy and go like, no, that's not it at all. You know, it's funny. Somebody called me on social media the other day, called me, what are you, a distributist? And I went, why, yes, I am. Thank you very much. But he meant it as an absolutely derogatory, like I was kind of pinko commie.
Right, which means that he doesn't know what it is. He's just read some, half-witted stuff which claims that distributors believe things they don't believe. I mean, at the heart of it, to take the title of Belloc's essay, which really is, the core of what distributism is, it's about the restoration of property, not taking property away, but restoring it to people. It's the opposite of socialism.
And not only are you restoring property, but you're restoring property for the purpose that man was. Okay, so you have two things here. Okay, the individual man was created by God to love God and then to find his way back to heaven from whence he was created. That's one. So man has a soul, as Brother Francis explains. A family does not have a soul, but man
is also created to be fruitful and go forth and multiply. So if you take the individual, the man, and then put him or her into this thing called the family, well, then the purpose that God created the family for was as a unit to be fruitful and multiply and to love him, of course. Then the system whereby the family can stay together and can all work on their salvation. Whatever system leads to that flourishing, that's the one we want, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And basically, a healthy society is a society where families are healthy. So where the family breaks down, society breaks down. It is literally, it's the cement that holds things together. So when you live in a system which is undermining the traditional family and what bonds and binds the traditional family together, you're living in a society which is in the process of collapse. And that's where we are at the moment. We don't have to defeat the liberalism. Liberalism is in the process of defeating itself. All that we need to do is to restore the health of a society rooted in good, solid traditional families. And that's why you do what you do, and that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, isn't it amazing, though, you know, when you think about how this should work how would you make this practical? Well, you don't have to think about it that much. It's not hard. Common sense. You know, it's almost as though somebody intelligently designed and planned this.
Right. I mean, yeah, if you have the family, things work. If you have the family, that don't work. So obviously, if the family's not fixed, fix it. I mean, that is the common sense. And how do you fix it? Well, you begin with yourself. I mean, if you want to change the world, you begin with yourself. You don't have abstract concepts about what, you know, what the president of Russia should or should not be doing. You actually get on in Simpsonville, South Carolina, or wherever you happen to live, and you make that little corner of the world a better place by doing the two great things that we're commanded to do, by loving the Lord our God and by loving our neighbor. And if you do that, the world become a better place. And the family is the place, by the way, where we're meant to exemplify loving the Lord our God and loving our neighbor. Our neighbor being our spouses and our children and our parents, that extended family, which is the root of all human society.
Joseph Pierce is the author of too many books for me to list. The last one that came out was Literature, What Every Catholic Should Know. Is that the last one?
That is correct, and there's none on the horizon either. I'm busy doing other things at the moment.
Wait a minute.
I'll get books again.
Wait a minute, Pierce. You mean you're not busy writing another book? This is the first.
I'm busy trying to write another book.
All right, I want to go to another subject before we get to David Brooks and his insanity. Henry V. Now, this is very interesting the way you put this to me. And when I thought about it, I went, okay, I can see that. So I watched Sir Kenneth Branagh's Henry V. And I actually talked to Fiorella about this. And a couple of things stood out to me. Number one, I got a pretty good history lesson there. I didn't even know what Agincourt was until I watched the movie. Fiorella gave me the lesson of the origin of the bird, of flipping the bird after Agincourt.
Yes, indeed.
But I got the eve of the battle on St. Crispin's Day, and then Henry V, you know, in the play, I guess, it calls for let there be sung non nobis in Te Deum, because this is the day that God has won. It's a quite beautiful speech by Branagh. And it kind of reminded me that, you know, Sir Kenneth, he made that movie when he was 31. He was 31 when he made it. He wrote, produced, and directed that. That's a pretty tall order, because there's some serious Shakespeare going on in there. Any comment you may have on Henry V or on Branagh's Henry V, and then, of course, on, because since you're the world-renowned expert on Shakespeare, how much did he get wrong?
Well, actually, you know, normally I avoid film adaptations of Shakespeare plays like The Plague because they really do horrible things to the bard. But the two exceptions to that spring to mind immediately are the two versions of Henry V, one with Sir Laurence Olivier, which is the earlier version, I think from the 60s.
It is.
Is it 60s or earlier? Was it 50s, 60s?
I think it was early 60s.
That sounds about right. And then, obviously, Kenneth Branagh's much more recent one, the both of which are marvellous, and I'm very happy to watch those. I don't find myself being offended by watching those. I think they both stay fairly true to the spirit of Shakespeare. I stay away from most of the others, but certainly Kenneth Branagh's Henry V is marvellous.
And there's some of the things that are in there that made me believe in Branagh's just brilliant portrayal of King Henry V, made me believe that, well, maybe Tolkien had borrowed from Shakespeare for the model of Aragorn and Boromir, but then you corrected me and said, no, Mike, Peter Jackson borrowed from Kenneth Branagh. And I think that's correct.
Yeah, basically what Peter Jackson obviously saw these very powerful images, Kenneth Branagh's and Laurence Olivier's speeches, such as the St. Crispin's Day speech you just mentioned, saw how powerful they were immediately before a battle, and basically put those words on the lips of Aragorn.
And now just to kind of tie a bow around that whole thing, this is what excites me, and what I know what excites you too, and you just said it. You watch those two films because they don't offend your Shakespearean senses. Film can be a very powerful, very beautiful way to convey the stories of life and show us and to help us appreciate the good, the true, and the beautiful when it's used properly and done correctly. And I think that those are a couple of good examples.
Indeed, absolutely. I mean, my general advice to people, I actually led a men's retreat in Hilton Head Island in South Carolina this past weekend, and one piece of advice I gave is to read more and watch less. And the reason I say that is because the watching is a very passive affair, where you let things wash over you. It can be very subliminal, which can also be dangerous. Whereas reading, your intellect, your mind is actually engaged with what you're doing. So you're actively involved proactively with the content. So I think that's actually a healthier way. It's a bit like lifting weights as opposed to just lounging around on a couch. You know, so I'm not saying people should not watch anything, and certainly they should watch Kenneth Branagh's Henry V and Laurence Olivier's Henry V and other good things and good films and other good movies. But I do think as a general practice, they should read more and watch less.
And by the way, the Baron of the Bard here, Joseph Pierce, is a renowned world expert in both watching film and crashing on the couch and what? World renowned expert. Okay, let's move on. What made you? What led you into this field of inquiry? I don't know you as an investigative journalist type. I really don't. I know you as a literary author, and that's what I read you for. But when I read the piece of Crisis Magazine, a brilliant piece about Jeffrey Epstein, there was some serious detective work going on in there. Did Michael Warren Davis suggest that to you, or is that your idea?
No, it was my idea. Basically, someone sent me, actually, it was a rather funny piece of inspiration. A friend sent me some graffiti about, just said that Jeffrey Epstein did not commit suicide. He said it's a joke because there's a infamous, known at least, meme of that's going around with graffiti when I was in prison in my bad days as a neo-Nazi, that people writing Free Joe Pierce all over the place, and some communists had put underneath, somebody had written Free Joe Pierce, and somebody had written with every packet of Nazi pops, which is funny from a communist perspective. But this person had written, Jeffrey Esman did not commit suicide with the free packet of Nazi pops as a joke. But then I thought, what is this about him not committing suicide? How true is that? And so that just set me going. And then, you say I'm not an investigative journalist. No, I'm not. But, when you write a biography and you wanted to pass muster amongst scholars, you do have to do your research. So there's a lot of research involved in writing a book. So, I do have a lot of experience doing research, not normally journalistic research, but when I got going on Jeffrey Esman, I became Not Jeffrey Esmond, sorry, he's a poet.
Epstein.
Yeah,
don't,
a poet.
Don't insult the poet.
Isn't it good that I've got Jeffrey Esmond, the poet, and not Jeffrey Epstein, the pervert, on my mind? Isn't that good? but basically, I became intrigued, about the whole story, and the deeper I got in his involvement with the Trilateral Commission, and the
CFR.
These sort of embryonic organizations, semi-secretive organizations of the super rich that are working towards globalization and globalism and the world, new world order. You know, the fact he was a key player in that, and it makes you wonder how many of those other key players were using the services of his abducted minors, young girls, and you know he was filming them. To what extent was he killed? Because there's a lot of film out there somewhere.
The
people don't want to become public.
Well, and then the other, I mean, the point, the title of the piece, I'm looking forward to it in my pile of prep now, had something about evil, evil walking among us, or something to that effect. And your point was, and this is what I thought, like, okay, this is totally applicable to our day. And I keep, you actually kind of jogged something in my meager intellect. And it made me think, well, you know what? That's actually a good talking point. You can use that. How is it possible that we have one entire political party that is now dedicated to infanticide? They're not talking about aborting babies anymore. Two things. They now admit that babies are babies at any point in gestation. They now admit we're dealing with human life. They don't care. They're going to kill it anyway. And now they're so oblivious to the sanctity of human life. Kill it up to the moment that it's born. And in some of these lunatics' cases, well, if it survives and it's not wanted, then the woman reserves the right to do what she wants with her body. Okay, it's kind of not her body anymore. Anyway, in any event, this is an evil that is, I started to think that pagans even practice this evil. We know that some of the Incans and the Aztecs did in Mexico, because Hernan Cortez told us. But this is an evil that the world had got rid of for the most part and now seems to be making a comeback. That's one thing. They're also now for chemical and physical mutilation of children. So my question to you, and I think is what you were writing about, was your point is, how can you be sanguine with that level of evil and not have it affect everything else that you do, to the point of you're a walk-in marked man for Satan to claim you and just end your miserable existence?
Yeah, I mean, they said the headline of my article was "The Devil Devours His Own," and the point is, when you play with the devil's fire, you're not going to get burned. You're going to end up, being with him forever in the flames, and that's the real danger that people need to be aware of. Particularly, as you say now, where the Democrats are actually openly advocating infanticide. It's not even couching it in language talking about fetuses anymore.
Nope.
And by the way, that is a sign that. That we have been successful. I mean, the pro-life movement has been successful in the argument because, they know they can't argue scientifically that a child becomes human at a certain point in the womb. You know, it's not human when it's 6 months in gestation, but it is human when it's 9 months in gestation. They know that's an absurd argument. They've been forced into a corner. So basically, they've come out like the devil fighting, and we're basically able to hell with it. Then, we do advocate the woman's right to kill a child in the womb right up to the moment of birth, and quite clearly, at the moment of birth, it's a baby, and if it's a baby, you're advocating killing babies. I mean, so the point is, what's happened, and it's a great thing that's happened actually, is they've been painted into a corner by good, solid, logical argument. They've had nothing. But finding themselves cornered like a rat, they've basically gone for the jugular, and they come out and say, yes, well, to hell with it. What's wrong with killing babies?
No, it is. And because they've been exposed, you know what the great irony here is, old friend? It's their science. They're the ones that are the scientisms They relied on it to plan their entire life and their existence and ours. And it's their science. It is the proper use of their science and applying their science and in discovery finding, no, that's a child. That's a child.
That's the difference between scientism, which is a bad and erroneous evil philosophy that basically believes that the physical sciences have all the answers to all the questions, which is clearly nonsense. But as distinct from science, which is merely the knowledge of the physical cosmos, and here we see the good thing, which is science, exposing the bad thing, which is scientism. And that's excellent because, you know, basically in the end, truth will out, including scientific truth.
And the scientific truth here, again, is baby, not fetus, Latin for baby anyway, not gelatinous blob of cells. And now that they've been completely exposed, look, all holds are, there's nothing holding this evil back now, except it seems for the most unlikely of all unlikely characters, and that comes in the form of the man I call the fourth Don John of Manhattan. Don John of Manhattan, the most unlikely defender of human life, the most unlikely bulwark, if you will, even natural law, secular point of view, but the most unlikely backstop. There he is, a rampart against what would certainly become, if they had the power to do so, a religious persecution, unlike that seen probably since maybe the Bolshevik days or the French Revolution.
Yeah, but if the Democrats are unleashed now, they basically have become more and more radical. So if President Trump does not win the next election and we have a Democrat government, then I think we can see, and I mean, you need to get ready for the roller coaster ride, because I think they are going to unleash their anger, their venom, their hatred against Christianity in general, against the pro-life movement, this is where it's a men from the boys at that moment. You know, your channel is called the Crusade Channel. We are going to have the spirit of crusaders. We are going to have the courage to stand up for our convictions and to resist by whatever means are appropriate the persecution that comes. So I mean, let's hope to God that scenario will not materialize. But if it does, we need to be ready.
No, you absolutely need to be ready. And how can we become ready? We can all become better distributists. There's that word again.
we do actually basically have to start living an alternative lifestyle in the best sense of the word. We have to live as Christians. We have to live as distributors. We have to live at those that are working towards a restoration of small local economies and small local government. And you're not going to get small local government with any power until you have a small local economy that has health and power. So we've got to start there. I know. So we've got to start literally practicing with every dollar that we spend and changing the world with every dollar that we spend. And that's a beautiful way of looking at things, because it means every day you're actually involved in the political struggle. Every day you're actually making the world a better place with the choices you make when you spend money.
It is a beautiful way to look at it. I don't have any problem with it. Joseph Pierce is the author of many, many books. Today's our Joseph Pierce Book Fair. I believe we have 7 titles in the Founders Trading Post at mikechurch.com/shop. If you put any 2 Pierce books into your cart, take 25% off those 2 books. We're practically giving them away. So go to mikechurch.com/shop. You can see the book behind me, Catholic Literary Giants, a book that you wrote, what, about 15 years ago? A Field Guide to the Catholic Literary Landscape.
Yeah, what I liked earlier, Mike, is when you said the word Master Pierce, and I thought you were talking about a masterpiece. I thought, which masterpiece did I write?
You have several masterpieces.
A masterpiece. I like that. It's difficult to say after a couple of brandies.
You guys and gals that are out there raising kids, if you want to know all about some of your favorite literary characters you can share with your kids, well, then the literature, whatever Catholics know, is a good book. Good start. The biography of Tolkien is another good one. The biography of Oscar Wilde is another good one. And then, of course, you have Narnia, Farther Up and Farther In, where you look at the work and the some of the meaning of the work of C.S. Lewis. So those are all in the store. We have all of those. So go get two today, and they'll both be 25% discounted. Let's move on to this ridiculous story that David Brooks has authored at The Atlantic. There's a couple of things that disturbed me about this, but then after listening to you, maybe I shouldn't be disturbed. Maybe I should be encouraged. It looks like it looks like Moloch is now just completely throwing his cards on the table. Okay, the nuclear family has now failed. It was a dumb idea anyway, and now we need new communal ways to live. I mean, this is basically, and I know you didn't read the whole piece because you probably couldn't stomach it. I couldn't either. But this is basically Brooks saying with the full imprimatur of one of the oldest journals, and it used to be a good one, literary journals in the United States, and that's The Atlantic, with the full imprimatur of The Atlantic, because that's the cover story for March, basically saying that God's plan will not and does not work, and so man has to invent a new kind of family. I mean, this is the devil just laying it on going like, okay, God, you're defeated. We defeated the family. Now the real fun starts, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a misunderstanding, as usual, by these people, because the point is that the nuclear family is actually about as old as nuclear weapons. The point is that in the scheme of history and the way things are meant to be, it is the extended family. We are supposed to look after our parents when they get old and not put them in a nursing home. We are obviously supposed to look after our children. We're also, you know, we're supposed to be connected to our uncles and cousins and nephews and nieces. I mean, that was the network that bound, the network of extended families that bound society together. So it was the breakup of the extended family that began the process of the breakdown of the family itself, including the nuclear family. The nuclear family is, of course, the nucleus of the extended family, or should we say that the extended family is made up of several nuclei, right? So the nuclear family is good, but it's meant to be supported by the extended family. So when the extended family disintegrates, which is what's happened as a consequence of the modern world in which we live, the nuclear family then is isolated from that support network of parents and cousins and uncles and etc. And left alone to fend for itself in hostile territory, and then begins to break down. Well, the answer to that is not to say, well, we've got to live in a commune now. The answer to that is to restore societies and communities where the extended family can once more prosper. That's the way. That's, you know, the way forward is to go back.
But they don't want to go back. And if you say, well, the way forward is to go back, whoa, what do you want to go back to the 14th century? I mean, no, I want the with the electronics in hand. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I tell you what, I mean, one thing we need to know is that every single century, the same struggles are being fought out. So the whole idea of the past being worse, no, the past in many ways, as regards to fabric, was the same thing. Virtue versus vice, good versus evil, and where evil triumphs, you have the corruption rampant. Now, whether that's the 14th century or the 21st century, that doesn't change. And certainly in the 21st century, corruption is rampant because we've forgotten what virtue is. And the absence of virtue is viciousness. And then we're living in a vicious society because literally the viciousness fills the void of the vacuum that's left when virtue is removed.
And, of course, one of the things that the good philosophers will say is that when a society is in a decline, a moral decline, the first thing that will go will be modesty. Modesty's gone. It's going to go. And isn't it interesting that at the start of the 20th century, you know, around what was called the Roaring Twenties, that the Holy Fathers at that time, Benedict XVI and Pius XI, both of them saw this is not a good thing. This is not a good thing. It's not going to turn out well for anything. Hold on, guys. Hang on, world. I might have something to say about this. Let me issue you a warning. And so they did, and everything that they, most of what they said what would happen if modesty did decline, and it's declined to the point now where, I mean, I know you don't let your kids watch TV, and kudos to you, and you don't watch it. There's practically pornography now on family television, on cooking shows. I mean, it has descended so far. Again, it's Moloch laying all of his cards on the table. He doesn't have very much further to go into the abyss here, but that does leave a tremendous upside. And I keep seeing this, the good, the true, and the beautiful. I keep seeing more people kind of come into this realization and going like, okay, I canceled insert digital service here. I've had it. I'm done with it. I got to protect my children from this. There is that sort of what Brother Andre Marie calls that sensus catholicus. There is that sort of the sense of the modesty and the regality of the old world. And when I say regality of the kings and the queens, kind of creeping back in here and wanting to see the light of the day. Do you think so, or am I being too sanguine?
No, I think you're completely correct. The point is, if the sexual revolution proves anything at all, it proves the necessity of chastity. In other words, it proves that the church's teaching is correct, that if you do not have chastity and the laws that surround chastity prevailing, you have anarchy in its place. And that's exactly what we're finding now. And so basically we need the restoration of chastity, and you can't have the restoration of chastity till we have its rediscovery. But the church, you know, is the beacon by which people can return to that purity which is necessary for a healthy society.
Now, a little final arc of discussion here. I don't know if you kept up with the news today, but yesterday was a banner day for sentence commutations and presidential pardons. Now, even if you don't know, you and I can still talk about this, because one of the things that I believe is missing in much of the modern world today, if not the vast majorities, upper 95%+, and unfortunately is also missing in some of the circles that you and I, some of the swimming pools that you and I are swimming in, and some of those traditional circles, we really do not have a grasp of our Lord's call that he who is first is last, who is last is first. If you do not have mercy on the man that went against you, my Father will not have mercy on you. You know, the whole left, the entire leftist world is in just in outrage today that the president would actually pardon and commute these men's sentences when it's fully within his constitutional power. But there's something else going on here with Don John of Manhattan. These are acts of mercy.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And then one, we do need to remember this, and I'm really pleased you brought it up, that the real mark of a Christian is charity, is love. And if we cannot love our enemies, we're not being Christian. Now, I know it's easier said than done, and we can rant and be angry at error and mistakes and the evil, but we should not actually hate the individual person that has those erroneous beliefs. In fact, they're miserable and unhappy because they have those beliefs. They need our prayers, they need our charity, they need our reason, and that's obviously what you're doing on the Crusade Channel, what I'm trying to do. You've got to try to reason with these people so they see the error of their ways. What you mustn't do is to find yourself hating them, because when you find yourself hating them, you're actually on their side. You've joined the side of the devil, of those who hate against those who love, and you've actually gone over to the other side, even if you don't realize it. So we do need to keep love in our hearts. Without it, we're lost.
And to see that the president of the United States, when he commutes these sentences or pardons whoever, the knee-jerk reaction, he's saying that theft is okay. He's saying that sentences have been served. You know, right. Punishments must be appropriate to crimes.
Well, you know, I reminded one of the things that really sort of caused me to open my eyes to the fact that Donald Trump wasn't all that I thought he might be was when he called off the airstrike in Iran after the Iranians had shot down the drone on the basis it would have killed several dozen people and the drone strike killed nobody. And he said that the response would be inappropriate. In other words, that, you know, they shot down a machine. We don't kill dozens of people because they shot down a machine. I mean, this showed someone has some common sense as regards the appropriate way of justifying an evil. You don't rectify a wrong with a wrong that's even worse.
But Joseph, he used the Augustinian word. He said, He said that the action would not be proportionate.
Yes. I know, and thank you for bringing that up, Mike. You're completely correct. And it was that language, which I'm sure was probably given to him by one of his speech writers, but call me a cynic. But at least it means he's surrounded by good people that are aware of the Augustinian understanding of justice. I mean, and mercy. So yeah, I mean, thanks be to God that there are people surrounding the president that have a true and appropriate understanding of what goodness, truth, beauty, mercy and justice are.
Now, these things are necessary. And this is what you would want in a good king, too. And the idea that, I mean, one of the tragedies that came out of the whole Shea impeachment thing, monarchy got clobbered by these people. We heard over for 48 solid hours they had the floor. And they spun these yarns of that every monarch and king and queen that had ever lived in history was a tyrant. And that's why we had our precious constitution that the president had shredded, because we weren't going to live under tyrants anymore. And I'm just trying to keep my cool by watching this going like...
Right. Yeah. First of all, of course, it's nonsense because you do get good monarchs, and that's just a lie to say otherwise. They are outnumbered by the tyrants, but then, you know, but the point is the democratic governments are also outnumbered by bad governments, outnumbering good by so it's not about the goodness of a government. The point is that what you need is good, just and noble rulers. That's what we need. And we do need ways of getting rid of tyrants when they emerge. That's another aspect of political philosophy.
But in Christendom, kings couldn't get away with being tyrants. They didn't get away with it for long. If the people didn't punish them and the barons didn't punish them, then in many instances, God would just intervene and go, okay.
Yeah, and the church was there as the checks and balances. That they know that the kings understood, at least until the whole notion of the divine right of kings came along, which is a perversion, King James I and others, where they basically said that a king, just by being king, is superior to everybody else and has a divine right because of his kingship. No, but that was a heresy and an error. But prior to that, you know, the whole point of Christian monarchy was it's one nation under God, including one king under God. And the church was there to bring the king down to size if he started acting in ways that were contrary to a Christian understanding of good and evil.
Okay, our time has expired. Joseph has got to go feed that rooster. And he's got to come up with a title for his next book and much more. Hey, are you going out on the road anytime this late winter?
No, actually, yes. Thanks be to God, I'm home for a few weeks now. The next time I travel is middle of March, and I'm going to Steubenville, Franciscan University of Steubenville, for a Chesterton conference. Although I am doing an online conference for the Crusade people, and I'm actually having a meeting with them later this morning, which I think you're going to be the MC at, right?
I am the MC, but we weren't supposed to announce that yet.
Oh, forget it.
You people didn't hear anything.
Yeah, that never happened.
No, it's gonna happen, and
but we don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, they'll find out all about it.
Sorry, I didn't realize there was an embargo on mentioning it.
Well, it's not, it kind of is, but hey,
it's the non-conference.
Okay. Remember, we're forbidden. We don't have secret societies. Remember. So that's our out. Well, we know we can't have secret societies, so. Well, I, of course, look forward to speaking with you again. I'm sure David Simpson's probably got you coming up in the queue sometime soon. It's always a pleasure and a delight. By the by, you know, I need to get you on the onto some of the things that we do here, because I think that not only would you enjoy listening to them, I think you might actually find an excuse to write about them. And our friend KV found an excuse and a way to write about Fiorella Nash's mystery series book. She's got number 3 of the Father Gabriel series out. You know,
yeah, I've got it in my hand as we speak. See No Evil, right?
Yes. So yeah. If I send you season 1 of 5-minute mysteries, and they're all about 6-7 minutes long, Fiorella wrote them. They're 12 episodes. If I send them to you, will you listen to them?
I will promise to listen to them, but I won't promise when.
Okay. Well, will you promise to give them to Susanna to listen to, because she will?
I will promise to give them to her too.
Okay.
And I will listen to them. I did say I will listen to them. I just not putting a time limit on it for myself. That's all.
Yeah, because it's pretty much what you and I and her talked about as Shavanya. And it's a they're just wonderful little enigmas. They're just there's wonderful little, and you had this this sweet, sultry little English voice telling the story, with this kind of creepy, mysterious music. And it's just something I think that, you know, that kind of family radio is what the world needs more of, because it's entertaining. It's not catechetical in any way. It's not news based. It's just it's an escape. What good literature should be.
Agreed.
Of course, it's against Pierce's maxim, though. You listen to it sitting down, and you're not moving and turning.
Well, actually, no. Audio. I think reading is better than listening to a book. But my daughter listens to an awful lot of audio books, and you do have to be more engaged when you have to listen than when you're just watching an image. So it's not exactly the same thing.
Well, I think you're going to like season one of the 5-Minute Mysteries. By the way, folks, coming out on iTunes in mere days. You can download the entire series or tell your friends to. And I hope that this is a hit for our sake too, but certainly for Fiorella, because she is a marvelous, wonderful talent, and I hope many more people in the world find out about her. So, having said that, Master, so what did I call you? You're the Baron of the Bard.
I'm honored.
You'll always be.
I'm not worthy to have to be juxtaposed with the Bard, but I'll accept it from you, mate.
You'll always be Field Marshal. You'll always be Master Pierce. You'll always be Brigadier General. But for this week, you're the Baron of the Bard. All right.
Well, thank you, Mike. I dominate non sum dignus.
Dominate non sum dignus at two. How do you like that? Now, you told me you don't speak Latin.
Well, I do speak. I speak the liturgical Latin you need to know for the Mass.
I know. Okay, and this is not a religious term, by the way. It came out of the Roman Senate. Ite missa est. The Senate is out of session. The Senate is out of session is what that means. All right, brother. Always good to talk to you. My best to you and your family, and we shall chat soon.
My pleasure as always, Mike. God bless you.
God bless you, too. All right. Love, love, love our regular interviews with Master Brigadier General Baron of the Bard, Pierce. What other radio station brings you that world-class level of just sheer logic, good, true, and beautiful reason, philosophy, common sense, critical thinking on stuff that's important? Name it. I can name it for you. And Wisdom Wednesday will continue in just a moment with Brother Andre Marie. We're just getting started here. It's called the Crusade Channel.
You know where the solution can be found, Mr. President? In churches. In wedding chapels, in maternity wards across the country and around the world. Mr. President, this is the real solution to climate change. Babies. Climate change is an engineering problem. Not social engineering, but the real kind. It's a challenge of creativity, ingenuity, and most of all, of technological innovation. And problems of human imagination are not solved by more laws. They're solved by more humans. More people mean bigger markets for more innovation. More babies will mean forward-looking adults, the sort we need to tackle long-term, large-scale problems. American babies in particular are likely going to be wealthier, better educated, and more conservation-minded than children raised in still industrializing countries. As economist Tyler Cowen recently wrote on this very point, addressing this very topic, quote, by having more children, you're making your nation more populous, thus boosting its capacity to solve climate change, close quote. Finally, Mr. President, children are a mark of the kind of personal, communal, and societal optimism that is the true prerequisite for meeting national and global challenges together. The courage needed to solve climate change is nothing compared with the courage needed to start a family. The true heroes of this story aren't politicians, and they aren't social media activists. They're moms and dads. And the little boys and girls that they are at this very moment putting down for naps or helping with their homework, building tree houses, and teaching them how to tie their shoes. The planet does not need for us to think globally and act locally so much as it needs us to think family and act personally. The solution to climate change is not this unserious resolution that we're considering this week in the Senate, but rather the serious business of human flourishing. The solution to so many of our problems, at all times and in all places, is to fall in love, get married, and have some kids. Thank you, Mr. President. I yield the floor.
Nah, Mrs. McGillicuddy, your house isn't haunted. You're lonely. Turn on the Mike Church Show.
And welcome back, Mike Church Show here on a Wisdom Wednesday. You know, we've been doing Wisdom Wednesday shows since 2013. When David Simpson used to come in every other week for Wisdom Wednesday on the old station in the old country. Now we are visited by the one and only Brother Andre Marie from the St. Benedict Center. Mike Church here with you on the Mike Church Show, longest running radio talk show ever in the history of Sirius satellite radio, record that can never be broken. Glad to have you with us here on the Crusade Channel, last live radio station standing. This portion of the program brought to you by the Founders Pass Membership Upgrade. At CrusadeChannel.com, so easy to do, folks, and benefits Crusade Channel so mightily. Simply log into your account at CrusadeChannel.com. Once logged in, click the My Account tab at the top of the page. Select Founding Brother Monthly, Founding Brother Yearly, Founding Father Monthly, Founding Father Yearly. If you really want to support the Crusade, Crusader level monthly or yearly, go to checkout. You'll get a prorated rate for whatever time period you're currently subscribed at. If it's yearly, it'll prorate you by the year. If it's monthly, it'll prorate that month. Your card's probably on file. You click, yeah, I'm all good with that, dude. Click OK. Bam, oh, bada, bing. You've just got your upgrade. When we see that you've upgraded a Founding Brother, then we enroll you manually in the Crusade Channel content app. Simply the best post live radio listening app in the history of the human race. There you go. It is. And it's so good that people go like, how come I can't listen to it live? Because it's not a streaming app. It is a content app. It has stuff that's already been recorded on it. It's worth the price of admission. So I hope you'll take advantage of that and upgrade your Founders Pass membership today. Again, CrusadeChannel.com. Log in, my account, upgrade. Tell me I sent you. All right, before we get to, well, you know what? I'm going to bring Brother Andre Marie in from the St. Benedict Center for our Wisdom Wednesday. There's some confusion amongst you people in the chat room at crusadechannel.com/chat. If we're going to have discussions in terms, and if someone chimes in and goes, we always have to have terms, that someone is correct. You just can't go around making stuff up, dude. Dudes. And I see it all the time. Nah, you're acting all like atheisty EE. Just because something can become corrupted does not mean that in its inert form that it is corrupted. It means it's corruptible. With that, Brother Andre Marie, am I correct? And good morning, brother.
Good morning, Mike. So I was just doing something technical when you said what you just said. So you said something about it means it could be corruptible, and I admit what just came before it.
I said just because something has become corrupted does not mean in its inert state it was corrupted or it is corrupt. It means it is corruptible. It has the potency to become corrupted.
Yes, it's a question of act and potency.
So, so there's this idea going on in the chat room. Justice is an atheist construct. No, justice is a cardinal virtue. And as I read this, you know, to the gentleman that's in there writing this, dude, you just need to take the Philosophy of Perennis course, because you'll learn that there are many virtues. You have your cardinal virtues, you have your theological virtues. And then from the theological virtues, then you have the gifts of the Holy Ghost, and those lead to the fruits. And I think there's one other in there in ethics that Brother talks about, right?
Well, higher than that still, you have the Beatitudes.
The Beatitudes.
Anticipation of the life of heaven. But justice means multiple things. Of course, as with all good concepts, as you say, there is always the potency there that it can be corrupted by somebody else. But the concept of justice is polyvalent. I mean, it has so many meanings. Mm. First of all, justice is sanctifying grace. When you speak of Christian justification, all of the wars between the true church and the Protestants during the time of the Catholic Reformation versus the Protestant revolt. You know, so the Council of Trent teaches us about justification. Well, what does that mean? It means being made just. What does that mean? That means being made right, being in the state of grace. So at one level, it's synonymous with the state of grace. At another level, as an infused and even acquired moral virtue, it's one of the cardinal virtues by which we render to the other what is his due. Whether it be God, in which case it's called the virtue of religion, or man, in which case it has multiple divisions of community of justice, distributive justice, and legal justice. So these are very important distinctions. Of course, what I just said about justice is not what most lawyers think justice is, right? So because we've so completely divorced American positive law and jurisprudence from the natural law and from the Christian patrimony of the West.
Let me just give a quick example. It would be an absolute heretical blasphemy for someone, from a woman to walk into an abortion clinic and say, I am here to get some justice for my child.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
It's an unjust act is the point.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, and we always have to. You know, Brother teaches us, and St. Thomas would teach us, and indeed Aristotle would teach us from the natural law point of view that there is a natural law, and that Brother, you and I could spend days on this, I'm sure, but this lie that somehow the spiritual laws are totally contravening and are in opposition to natural laws. That's exactly backwards. That's just wrong.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in as much as any positive statute of the civil law, or even court case. So in American jurisprudence, we have two kinds of law. We have statutory law, and we have trial law. We have the law that comes from legal precedent. And when attorneys argue cases, they cite both statute and legal precedent as decided by that third branch of our government.
Stare decisis, they call it.
So that whole So either one, whether it's a court case like Roe v. Wade or some statute which says that it's a natural right for somebody to procure products or for birth control, those contradict the natural law. Therefore, they're not actually laws. If as soon as it contradicts the natural law, it's not an ordinance of reason. It's not for the common good. It might be promulgated, and it might be promulgated by him who has authority in the community. So I'm going through St. Thomas's four aspects of what constitutes a law. But if it's not an ordinance of reason, in other words, if it's inherently unreasonable, and if it's not for the common good, if it contradicts the common good, then you don't have what's rightly called the law. You have something else.
So I thought that was a good just something we could talk about. And again, go to store.catholicism.org and go in the downloads department, the MP3 department, and you can check out the Philosophia Podeni's course. Well worth your time and your investment. You think Brother Francis would? I wonder sometimes what Brother would think about some of us that years after we've taken the course are still taking it. Like, I never tire of listening to that man. I just don't.
Well, he would appreciate that.
And it whenever I have a question, I go, okay, I can't answer this, and I'm struggling with it. I'm just going to check out. I'm going to go listen to some Philosophia Perennis, and I'll come back to the question. It's amazing to me how the study of Philosophia Perennis and to mystic or scholastic philosophy, if you will, that, you know, if you study it with an open mind and an open heart, and if when you start to grasp it, that the world becomes cyclical and things start to fit. So much so that you go, like, this is a created order. This is a perfect system designed by a perfect being. It can't be any other way. And this is what leads to hashtag life ruined. Because you see that, but in the world we live in, brother, we're not in a majority.
No, but, you know, I do think that more and more people are seeing it.
Yes. And that's good.
And we have to realize that in God's providence, people will continue that in God's providence, He works through human history in real concrete ways that we can't forecast, we can't expect. It's not like there's some law by which we can forecast the actions of divine providence. There are all kinds of surprises in human history, but when we study history, we see that there are these ebbs and flows, these high points and these low points, and we've been going through quite the low points in recent memory. But I think one of the ways that God works through human history is that the low points bring us to a point where we acknowledge our need for Him. And where we acknowledge our need for his law, and then we decide that we're going to convert because we're sick of, like the prodigal son, we're sick of starving for the stuff that we're feeding to the pigs that we've chosen to wallow with, and we want to return to our Father's house. And this is how God works in human history. He really does. And we see it in our own lives. We see it in the Bible gives us an inspired sacred history. And the Old Testament was not given to us, and the follies of the God's chosen people in the Old Testament weren't given to us so that we could read it and say, hey, Jews, you know, it must really stink to be you. Look how much you guys screwed up. You know, you kept falling into idolatry. You kept doing this, kept doing that.
Right.
Our Lord says that those things were written for those of us upon whom the these latter days have come. In other words, we're supposed to profit by this example. So we see this sacred history where the very chosen people of God, to whom He showed His love and mercy and solicitude by all of these extraordinary acts, you know, following them for 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, or leading them, I should say, by a cloud of a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, having all of these manifest miracles, giving them water in a desert, coming out of rocks and things like that. This entire production, if you will, of God's providential and extraordinary, miraculous designs for that one people gives us a pattern for how God works in history. Not that we are all to always expect miracles, but that we are to be convicted and convinced that God is real, that his law is to be followed, that he actually does care for us, that he actually will be faithful to his promises. And if that applies to the Jews of the Old Testament, how much more does it apply to the Christians of the New Testament, who have a higher law, who have a superior priesthood, who have a better covenant, and for whom the divine promises are to be seen not to be fulfilled so much in this life as in the next. See, one of the things about the Old Testament, St. Thomas says that the Old Testament is for children, the New Testament is for adults. And one of the reasons is because adults are into, or should be, into delayed gratification. Many of the great prophets and patriarchs and great ones of the Old Testament were given blessings in this life. So even Job, who showed his patience after he had lost all this stuff, at the end of the book, he gets it all back.
He gets it all back.
Manifold. I mean, he gets even more than he had before. We see these sort of carnal, earthly blessings given to the faithful of the Old Testament. St. Thomas says that doesn't apply to us in the New Testament because these are all types of a greater reality. Now we have more grace. Now we have the sacraments. Now we have something so much greater. And because of it, we're given the ability to look forward to rewards that are not terrestrial, that are not carnal, that are not earthly, but that are heavenly. And we mentioned the Beatitudes before. You know, read the Sermon on the Mount, read the Beatitudes. That's what we're anticipating, not, you know, better luck today than I had yesterday.
Brother Andre Maria, the St. Benedict Center, by the by, I took the liberty of looking this up before the show, so I didn't have to ask you. Episode number 21 to the 7 tonight. Of Reconquest, starring our dear friend, Brother Ryan Grant. And what are you two going to be talking about?
The Mass is a true sacrifice.
And, of course, Ryan Grant, a Latinist and an author, in his translator in his own right, has translated many works, including those of St. Robert Bellarmine, and put them into English. He's also, Brother, you're familiar with this, and I don't want to get off the subject here quickly, are you familiar with Father William Most and Latin by the Natural Method?
I know who Father William Most is. I'm not familiar with that book. No, he was Father Most was a petrologist.
Okay, so that means he studied popes?
No, but the fathers of the church.
Oh, okay. Petrologist.
Petrologist, right. Yeah. He knew all of the languages. I mean, he knew Greek, he knew Latin, he knew... I believe he knew some Semitic languages, too. He was quite the erudite fellow.
Well, Mediaxer Express publishes Latin by the Natural Method by Father William Most, and it's a very fun, interesting way to learn Latin because he basically tells you the story of Rome from the Punic Wars to the Etruscans to Carthage must be defended. Carthagio delenda est. Carthago delenda est. I'm getting off the subject. Anyways, Ryan published that. He put that book into print. You can get it from Mediatrix Press.
Okay, grand.
All right, so brother, Mrs. O'Connell, do we not have the newspapers? Or I saw this the other day, and I meant to ask you. Okay, it's in my bag then. I put it in my bag. Does the name Father Zucchius mean anything to you?
Father Zucchius?
Yes.
No.
He was a Jesuit, and he was an astronomer. And there's a crater on the moon named for him.
Well, there were many, many, many Jesuit astronomers. You have to realize that when the Papal Observatory was begun back, I want to say 16th century, it was put in charge of the Jesuits.
Okay.
So there's always a Jesuit who's the head of the Papal Observatory. The current one, I think, is actually a Jesuit lay brother. He's a nut job.
Tell me what you really think, brother.
Well, no, I mean, look, this man attacks the notion of intelligent design. That's how far removed from
Catholic
idea of of cosmology he is, cosmology study, you know, in the empirical sense. Yeah, he's that's what I think it's totally justified to call him a nut job.
Oh, I agree.
I mean, it's not just an ad hominem attack. It's based upon reality. I don't even know the man. I couldn't launch an ad hominem attack against him. I'm basing that on what he said. But yeah, the Jesuits, you know, when they were good, bad, or indifferent, were always heading up that observatory. And I understand that there are many different heavenly bodies named after Jesuits as a result of this.
There are. So it's Father Zucchi. I said Zucchius. 1586-1670, an Italian priest, astronomer, and physicist. What I found interesting about this was I said, I wonder if brother knows this prayer, because father wrote this prayer, and not only is he an astronomer, but he's the author of this prayer. Check this out. My sovereign, my mother, I give thee myself entirely, and to show my devotion to thee, I consecrate to thee this day my eyes, my ears, my mouth, my heart, myself wholly and without reserve. Wherefore, O loving mother, as I am thine own, keep me, defend me as thy property and thine own possession. Beautiful little prayer. And
well, that's almost an anticipation of St. Maximilian Maria Kolbe's spirituality of total consecration, because he preferred to use the word property.
Well, and did you mention that? And this is in the Catholic Illustrated. Out of all this, however, that which this great priest would most be remembered by of his life is this holy prayer. By and large, his memory has been perpetuated in this, sometimes without a direct reference and possibly even knowledge that it came from him. Father Zucchi's prayer was incorporated into many other consecrations. For example, the prayer of total consecration by St. Maximilian Kolbe. So,
well, who wrote the article?
So it's an anonymous author. It's in the Alpine Redemptorists, who aren't Alpine Redemptorists anymore. What do they call themselves now?
They are the Sons of the Most Holy Redeemer.
Yes,
I believe.
The Sons of the Holy Redeemer, Catholic Illustrated from San Stray Island, their newspaper, and this is last summer's issue, I believe. Anyway, thought I would just mention that. That's not the subject of our conversation.
Well, I agree with that author, and you know what they say. Great minds think alike, and fools rarely differ. So I'll let you figure out which is which. I'll let you figure out which one applies.
All right, I want to play a short clip of Brother Francis from Ethics Number 14. And so Joseph and I talked just for maybe 2 minutes on this subject, but I think because it's from Brother that it's worthy of hearing. So just hold tight, Brother. We'll listen to this, and then we'll talk about it, okay?
Gladly.
Study life. We study the highest manifestation of life, which is in the visible world, in the material world, which is man himself. And then we come to ethics. And in ethics, we discover one principle, very simple to state, but of tremendous consequences when you stop to think about it. And it's the only thing worth thinking about. It's the whole secret of sanctity, and it's the whole secret of success when this life is over. We discover the purpose for which man was made. And when we say that purpose, it has consequences in every field of thought or activity. It's after that we are ready to face the different systems of thought that have undermined this wisdom that at one time was the treasure of the Christian world. We discover that the wisdom of the Church, as it is expressed finally in knowing the true nature of the end for which we were made, depends on everything else we say. If we had not been thinking correctly on all those levels, we would never reach the right conclusion in the end. So that every kind of error that the mind can make will subvert this high wisdom. And then we learned that ethics, the early sages, divided it into three parts. That part of moral principles that applies to an individual person. They called it monastics. Then that part which applies to the government of a household, a family. And they call it economics. And then, again, the same rules of morality which derive from the knowledge of the supreme good through happiness, as applied to the other natural society to which we must belong, and that's the state. And they called it politics. Economics comes from the Greek word for home. Politics comes from the Greek word for city, the city-state. Well, when we take these words from the early sages and apply them to our time, obviously we have to modify them a little, but a knowledge of their origin is very great help. The field now is so large that we can spend the rest of our life talking on the subjects that are open before us. But that's not my purpose of this course. I would like to proceed very soon to the polemical part where we see the men who made the modern mind and where they deviated from the right path. How is it that we live in an age that, according to the language of the scripture, we'd say it an age not of wisdom, but of the very opposite of wisdom, an age of folly. Most people, most societies, most thinking, most acting, most activities in the world today are the activities of fools. Now that's going to be very exciting, but it can only be done when we already have something to defend. We have established a foundation. We have built a little castle. We believe in it. We think it is true. It's objectively true. It's a wisdom partly revealed by God, partly arrived at by the sound thinking. In the history of the world, there's no other school of thought that had had many adherents. And some of the adherents, most of the adherents, are the best thinkers this world has known. So we do have a marvelously traditional wisdom that we want to defend.
Okay. A lot to unpack there. That's you guys that have philosophy of penance, that's ethics number 14. Because I know I just joggled some people's memory, go like, man, I want to go back and listen to that one. Ethics number 14. Brother, so much that we could talk about here, but I think that what brother, and this lecture is just marvelous, and I sent you a note about this. There's just a, he's reviewing, I think he's getting ready to wrap up ethics here. But just the logic and the applicability, and then of all of the wisdom that you're teaching and what you're learning, but you're learning so that you can defend something. And yeah. And then brother says there was an age of wisdom, and this age is an age of folly. So we don't learn things so that in the direct material wealth gathering sense it leads to money, because he covers that later. Well, we learn them so that we can defend the good, the true, and the beautiful. And that's what I wanted to talk with you about today.
Okay. Fair enough.
So I leave you with that. It's your course. So,
well, what? I mean, where do you want to go with it? I mean, there are so many threads that brother spoke of here.
Let's talk about the Greeks. Okay. The Greeks give us the study of economos, or is it koinomos? Economy.
You're talking about the three different branches of ethics.
Right.
So we've got monastics, economics, and politics.
Let's do economics, because this is the one I think that the other two are screwed up too. But this is the one that I think has led to so much decay, so much moral depravity is not understanding the economics of the home. And in this lecture, he explains it in a way that is so pure and so simple that anyone that would take the time to listen to it would get it. He even says, brother, he says that, can you apply the ethics of the home to the rest of the world? And he goes through and answers the question, not only can you, but you should.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that.
Well, there's an order to this.
Yes.
That needs to be noted first.
Okay.
So they're all ethics. They're all branches of ethics. We begin with monastics, which is personal ethics. You know, the life of virtue practiced by an individual.
Okay.
And that from there follows economics, which is not to be confused, at least not exclusively, with the modern study of economics, which really has to do completely with money and with large scale kinds of transactions, not so much household economics. In fact, the funny thing is, you know, I remember when I was in high school, especially in girls' schools, they would have these courses called household economics.
Home ec.
Yeah. Well, home ec is a redundancy when you look at the original meaning of the word, which was the practice of ethics in the family, in the home, huh? How you run a home. Now, we talk about the divine economy of salvation, and what we mean by that is the way that God handles his own household. You know, he directs a house. We're all in the house of God, huh, in the church, and there is a way that he interacts with other members of the household. So
right.
It's not removed from the original etymological meaning of economics. In fact, in certain institutions, there's somebody who bears the title economos, and this is the person who is kind of like the majordomo, the right hand man, the number two of the ruler, because he has to do with the day to day running of the kingdom or of whatever the institution is. His title was economos. So it's economics here in its most literal sense is this the study of running a household, not just money, but providing for everything, all the needs of the members of that household. Now you can see that if your monastics is messed up, that your economics are going to be messed up. Of course, the economics, meaning the household ethics, are going to be correct. I mean, what I should say is this: the household economics is a place where the children are taught by the parents how to live the life of virtue, right? How to live according to virtue,
sure.
How to live according to prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude.
Right.
And the provision that the parents will make for their children in material things, as well as in the spiritual goods of teaching them virtue, and then the higher spiritual goods of teaching them supernatural virtue, faith, hope, and charity, at least informing those virtues and giving examples of them, because those virtues have to be infused. They can't be acquired. That gives us the place wherein virtue is learned, the monastic virtue of the children is learned. In other words, the individual virtue of each of the parents is to create an atmosphere in the home so that the monastics of the parents becomes the economics of the home, and the economics of the home informs the monastics of the children so that when they get beyond adolescence and enter into full adulthood, they have the same sort of monastic values, the same virtues that their parents had. And when you take that and when you take multiple household economies that are well lived, then you have a politics that is going to be rightly ordered. So it all sort of branches out from the home. And that's why, you know, Joseph, I heard when I was driving back from Mass this morning, I clicked on the app And although things are sort of intermittent for various reasons, most notably being in rural New England,
right.
I did catch a lot of what you said, and he talked about, you know, starting in the home, talking about Plato's notion of democracy as a degenerating into mob rule, then anarchy, then tyranny. And he contrasted that with a more authentic form of democracy, which also included the Catholic concept of subsidiarity. Now, he talked about, you know, if you want to change the world, start with yourself. And then he talked about how then the home becomes the natural place where you make these changes. So you see that monastics immediately feeds into economics. Now, and then the economy of the home, if you have enough homes functioning rightly, are going to have an impact on politics. Not necessarily electoral politics at the federal level, as in the American Republic, but at least locally. I mean, for instance, here we live in a tiny little town where we still have New England town meetings. And I told you about this.
We talked about it last week.
Yeah. So if you have enough households that believe in certain concepts of Christian virtue and even natural virtue, when it comes to town meeting, a significant number of, I mean, even a few committed people can we can actually affect the local politics. We can say, no, we're not going to give tax money to support that nefarious thing. I can remember at one of our town meetings, one of our people stood up and said, I don't want to give to that organization because they support abortion. And there was an audible hiss coming from a woman who, if you saw her, you would think that hisses could sort of go with her.
Simca Fisher.
She had been at one. I did not say that. She had at one point been an employee of Planned Parenthood and a PFLAG, which, if you know what PFLAG is, it's an organization for parents of sodomites and analogous.
Yes.
People. So this woman was quite the piece of work, and quite the activist, you know, against everything that we hold dear. And, you know, she made this sort of diabolical hiss when one of our ladies, modestly attired and so forth, made this. So I only cite that as an example of how, you know, personal morals, monastics, monos in Greek means alone, huh, goes into economics, which comes from the Greek word for home. So in other words, the way that virtue is lived in the family, the way that ethics are lived in the family, and then that informs the politics. So the conversion of the nation is going to have to happen through people's homes. We don't live in the days of a monarchy anymore, where
nope.
When the apostles were evangelizing, they could evangelize kings and people in positions of importance. And when they did that, not so much that the apostles evangelized kings, although they did interact with royal personages and heads of state and so forth. But later apostles of nations like those who evangelized England, they met with the kings. And when the kings converted, generally speaking, their people converted. I mean, how did Russia convert? Well, Saint Vladimir, the king, converted. And he tells his army, okay, guys, we're getting baptized now. and they did. And one of them famously said, it wasn't Vladimir. I can't remember the ruler who it was. I'd have to look it up. But one of his soldiers said, we will adore what we burned and we will burn what we adored when they realized that they had to convert to Christianity. So this is one of the – it's not the only way, but it's one of the ways – that the faith penetrated into these societies. When the king became the sort of the standard bearer of the faith, he greatly aided the evangelization of his people. And a lot of times, as in the case of, say, Saint Clotilde, for example, there was a good queen who actually was the the one who motivated the king to do the right thing. That's one of the interesting lessons of history, as how saintly women who are truly feminine, huh, and truly saintly, who aren't feminazis, can actually influence the conversion of an entire nation. And more than one nation owes its conversion, at least in some part of the important part of the chain of causality, to a saintly woman who was a good influence on the king. So, the politics of the nation can be influenced by this concept of virtue. Virtue lived in the individual, the monos, and then in the home, and economics.
So now you see the importance of this. Brother Andre Marie from the St. Benedict Center and the host of Reconquest Radio here on Wisdom Wednesday with your kind, humble host, Mike Church. I want to go back to the home, though, because we're going to try to keep this timely today, because Mrs. O'Connell has been on me to shorten this show and to keep people wanting more. And
speaking of virtuous women who affect their husbands for the good.
Oh! Now, she's going to... Brother, I have to live with this woman. You just enlarged the cranium. What are you doing? I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding. This is a point that I want to hit on here, so we got a good foundation here. So let me move on to something that Brother said about this. And he talks about the prudence of the wife, of the mother of the home, that, you know, you have money coming in, wealth coming in that the man goes out and creates, but there's 500 spoons that are reaching into the house saying, hey, you got to pay me. And that in the economy of the house, that the wife has to measure it, and she has to be prudent with it. She has to actually know, okay, husband, this is all you've given me, then this is what we can do with it, or this is all that I can do with it. So she is, for the benefit of the family, she manages that, and she manages it in a prudent method. And then in a prudent way. So she's relying on the grace of prudence, or the virtue of prudence. But then Brother gets into something where he says, and the way that the modern world has departed in the most profane way is in what the wife knows are needs and desire. She knows the difference between a need and a desire. We do not know the difference between needs and desires, Brother Andre, do we?
No. I mean, I don't think so.
Well, not and everyone. We do know that, some.
Yeah, I mean, you mean it's the society at large.
Society at large, right.
And of course, this is a direct result of capitalism, at least the I would say capitalism, period, but at least capitalism understood in the sort of usurious and highly mercantile way the commercialism that we're exposed to constantly,
right,
and have been. I mean, I grew up in a society that just drowns in commercials and in the promotion of all sorts of things. I was just teaching my students, Mike. I teach them rhetoric, so we have a rhetoric class.
Okay,
and I was pointing out, we were talking about the different appeals that Aristotle gives in his book on rhetoric. There are three appeals. There's the appeal, you'll recognize this, there's the appeal to logos, there's the appeal to ethos, and there's the appeal to pathos. All of them legitimate appeals within rhetoric. Aristotle doesn't deride any of them, although he points out the dangers of principally one of them. So logos is, of course, the appeal to reason, huh? Logos, that very pregnant Greek word that St. John grabbed to explain what Jesus Christ is. But it had all sorts of meanings prior to that. But, of course, we get the word logic from it. So you can see where we're going with that one. So logos, the appeal of logos is strictly logical argumentation. Then there's the appeal of ethos, which appeals mostly to the goodness, the virtues of the speaker, which, you know, he has to be artful the way he does that, because if he doesn't have enough virtue, he has to not point that out.
Sure.
But you know, you can find in good rhetoric, you can find that good rhetoricians constantly appeal to the good things that they did in thinking about this issue and coming to this conclusion. So that's an argument from ethos. And then you have the argument from pathos, which is emotion, huh? So the passions or the emotions. And Aristotle points out that you have to be very careful about this. Of course, today – so I point that out to my students. In making Aristotle's point, I pointed them to something that Aristotle didn't know about, modern American mercantilism and commercialism. And I said, look at commercials. I said, actually, don't. But if you must, if you're exposed to someone, note how they're appealing to you. It's mostly pathos, and it's mostly pathos in terms of the seven deadly sins. So the appeals are mostly to pride, covetousness, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. This is what they're appealing to in these commercials. And you can pretty much – you know, bank on it, you know. So, I mean, women are sold clothes. Well, lust, vanity. So pride and lust, you got two right there. And how clothing is marketed to women. Perfume. I mean, I can remember these perfume commercials when I was a kid. And, you know, you got these half-naked people.
Today they're two-thirds naked, brother.
Yeah, well, okay. I'm glad I don't watch commercials.
No, anymore. You're not but missing anything.
My point here is that the appeal of pathos that we get in our commercials. I can remember you deserve the very best. I mean, how many times have you heard that? But that's a direct quote from a commercial that sure. I recall from my youth. Well, what is that? That's an appeal to your pride. Yeah, I deserve the very best. I mean, yeah, of course I do. I mean, Dan, I'm great.
It's me we're talking about. Of course I deserve the best.
They're not going to – if they want to sell their products, they're not going to get on and give you straight logical arguments. They're just not. That doesn't work. It would take too long. People would have to go through the laborious effort of thinking. And, you know, that just – that their market studies tell them that people don't think. They don't want people thinking because if people think, they might realize that that thing's way overpriced and it's not going to do what they say it does. And it's actually bad for them. It's bad for them from the point of view of virtue. It could be even bad for them from the point of view of physical health or well-being. But you know, if they have actually a good product, it can kind of sell itself. And I'm not saying it's unethical to make appeals to pathos. What I'm saying is we have to be careful. And this is what we get in an economy based upon usury. And based upon what's called – it's a consumer economy. In other words, we have to just keep selling stuff. It doesn't have to be good stuff. It doesn't have to be helpful stuff. It doesn't have to be necessary stuff. Just keep selling stuff. That's how our economy works. And that's a miserable economy. That's a miserable status quo.
And then brother gets into the end of this lecture here. He gets into – because he gets asked a question by someone who – sounds to me like is – what was our lecturer, our guest lecturer at this past SBC conference? Larry – he's the third order.
Are you talking about Carl
– Carl.
Yeah, Carl Phillips.
That's who sounds like to me is asking the question. I don't know if Carl was there at the time, but it sounds like Carl Phillips.
No, he wouldn't have been there.
Okay. Anyway, he's asking a question about it. He goes, well, you can go to Sears and Roebuck. He's very New England, this guy. You could go to Sears and Roebuck, and I can go down there, and if I want to buy a refrigerator, you know, they'll sell it to me on Sears and Roebuck credit. But then I got to pay interest on the credit. And then, brother, is this a usury? And then he asked brother the question. And then brother gives him a marvelous explanation and says, yes, it is. And then there is the explanation of why it is a usury. Now, I've said this before, and I said this on the old station in the old country. It's probably one of the reasons I ain't there anymore.
You can't go after usury, Mike.
No. If you were to eliminate usury in the American economy, you would have, one-third of the precious GDP we were talking about that you have today? Economic activity would come to a near halt compared to what it is today. Now, digest that a noodle on that for a bit.
So that means that we are all consuming things that are all desires. Most of what we consume is desire. It's not need. From the size of cars and televisions and square footage in homes and this and that and the other. But it's all presented to us that, oh, but it's freedom and it's liberty. Well, actually, it's a horrible allocation of resources is actually what it is. And it leads people away from the real purpose of why they're here.
So, Mike, can I make a point about your use of the word desire?
Yes,
so
please.
You're contrasting desires from needs. Those two need not be antithetical to one another. Desire isn't necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's not.
I mean, obviously, we have to conform our desires to an informed intellect, right?
How about if we say lusts and needs?
Oh, there you go, because there you clearly conveying the idea of concupiscence. Now, lust, of course, generally people think of it in terms de sexto et de nono, to use the Latin. In other words, they think of venereal lust,
right.
but in the biblical use of the word, where St. Paul says the flesh lusteth against the spirit and the spirit lusteth against the flesh, it just means concupiscence, huh? So in the modern biblical translations that say from Saint John, all that is of the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. We say concupiscence of the flesh, concupiscence of the eyes, and pride of life in the Reims New Testament. The point here being, yeah, lust is a good word for that, but it's not just sexual. Lust is any sort of disordered appetite for something. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about disordered appetites. We're not talking about reasonable appetites, appetites that are in conformity with reason. And that's what we, you know, when you talk about living the good life, meaning living the virtuous life.
That is the good life.
That is the good life. Now, there is, as some of the greatest spiritual writers say, there is a place in the spiritual life for pleasure. We have excised pleasure and made it okay. It's just like what the pharmaceutical industry does, Mike. I just thought of a great analogy.
All right,
stick with me. So the and I hope Maggie's not freaking out now. That virtuous woman.
Oh, she's losing it in the other room, brother.
Uh oh. So what does the pharmaceutical industry do? They find something in nature that's got some healing property, right? And they say, well, you know, we can't make money off this thing. But you know what? If we extract the thing in it that seems to be the active ingredient that actually heals you, right? You know, there's this stuff in garlic that's supposed to be super good for you. And so you eat the garlic and you get it. But, you know, if they can just isolate it and make it and then enhance it by like 1,000%.
Right.
And then patent it because they somehow modified it, right? Then they can charge you hand over fist, you know, for this stuff. They can charge you, they can make, you know, they make the markup in the pharmaceutical industry is insane. So they can now get a patent on that thing. Nobody else can sell it. And the drug company's making money hand over fist because they've just taken this one thing that God put in nature and extracted it from its entire context and its entire delivery system, which may have actually been food, right? And then they sell it to you at an insane amount of money. And sometimes then you find out that, well, yeah, but because it doesn't have the other stuff that God put with it in nature, it's not working. Or it's causing unexpected side effects. Anyway, what do we do with the pleasure that God put into certain things? So, for instance, obviously, I don't need to tell any married folk out there, there's a certain pleasure that's attended upon sexual intercourse. Well, yep. God put that there. It's not evil. It's good. But it's part of a context that has a whole complexus of goods. The chiefest of which is the rearing and begetting of children. And when you take that and when you excise that one short, brief moment of ecstatic pleasure and you make that the summum bonum, you've done the equivalent of what the pharmaceutical industry has done in synthesizing evil pharmaceuticals.
Mm.
Okay, you've extracted something from its God-given context. And chances are you're going to make druggies of people out of it, right? So people are – you talk about porn addiction, you know, sex addiction,
all
this
stuff.
By the way,
brother, quick distinction or quick explanation. Summum bonum, highest good, right?
Yes, the highest good.
Highest
yes.
good, okay.
So the philosophers frequently ask themselves, what's the summum bonum? You're going to have a summum bonum absolutely, and that's heaven. And you're going to have a summum bonum, you know, sort of relatively in this particular context. What is the highest good? But it doesn't just go for sex. It goes for any pleasure, any kind of enjoyment. So the responsibilities, the duties, the necessary virtues to be practiced, when you take that larger context and you take some good that's experienced with it out of that context and you enhance it and you multiply it and you concentrate it, you're doing something wrong. That's a disordered desire. Okay, that's what we mean when we talk about a disordered desire. So that's why we need to conform our desires to right reason, and of course, our reason obviously has to be conformed to God's law, both the natural law and the revealed law.
Now, we're going to wrap this up, but we're actually going to stay under an hour for the first time here.
Maggie?
And maybe make a then we can actually make a YouTube video out of this. Brother, just to summarize, what we just talked about here was what is called in the study of Philosophia Perennis, is called ethics. And guys, again, if you want to catch up on this particular lecture, it's ethics number 14. But the reason why I wanted to bring it up is because every single one of us can get this. We all have houses. Most of us have wives. And most of us are out in the workplace. And we're all consumers. And we've all, at some point in our lives, elevated the consumption of Chinese tchotchkes as a summum bonum. This is what is disordered in society, which is why your mutual friend and mine, John Horvat, the great student of Professor Plinio Corjeda de Oliveira, wrote that the great book Revolution and Counter-Revolution, founded the tradition, family, and property. And John Horvat's interpretation or his homage, if you will, to his mentor is called Return to Order.
Yeah.
And it's that order that we need to always be thinking of, which is why when some people go like, Mike, I just don't get why you did some of the things that you do in your business. It was wrong. Like, well, some of the things that you're doing are unethical, and I won't do them. It's not ethical to do some things in the current business model where wealth is all that is mattered to be created. It's not ethical. And if we want to actually live the good life, if you said, well, then Mike has to at least make an attempt to try and live the virtuous good life as a merchant, which we used to do. And we used to have these things called guilds that made sure that if you were a gilded tradesman in whatever trade, you weren't an obnoxious, usurious creep.
Yeah, and there was something called quality, too.
Yes.
And there was something called a uniform standard within the trade. And there was something called not undercutting your guild's brethren. You know, the dog-eat-dog world of business was not something that you had in the guilds. Why? Because these are your brothers. You don't eat them. You're not a dog, and they're not dogs. You treat them like Christians. So you exercise the virtue of charity over and above the virtue of justice. And by the way, justice meant you paid a just wage to people who worked for you and you charged just price. There was no price gouging.
No.
It wasn't just blind market forces determining price. There were actual ethical standards.
So what I want you guys to take out of this brief Wisdom Wednesday, and it was a really good one, is that you should consider downloading the entire course on Philosophia Perennis at store.catholicism.org. You will not go wrong. You'll have it for the rest of your life. It will change your life. Hashtag life ruined is something to aspire to. And I hope you will aspire to hashtag life ruined. Brother, we already found out what's on Reconquest episode number 217 with Ryan Grant tonight, which debuts tonight. So now I'd like to segue into my story, to my Wisdom Wednesday example. And, of course, I get all of these from this wonderful magazine book that we have in the Founders Trading Post called The Glories of Mary, the first part on the Salve Regina. And it's written by, of course, Brother St. Alphonsus Liguori. By the by, Brother, who is St. Alphonsus? What is St. Alphonsus the patron saint of? Or is he multiple patron saints?
Well, I'm sure he has multiple patronages, but he's the founder of the Redemptorist Order. He's also he is the patron saint of moral theologians. Oh. And he's called the Doctor Theologiae Moralis, if I'm not mistaken, the Doctor of Moral Theology.
Okay. Interesting. Well, this comes from, again, if you're watching this, get this in the Founders Trading Post. As a matter of fact, while you're getting it, go ahead and get the Consecration to St. Joseph book, which begins on March the 30th. You guys need to go ahead and order those books, because if you're going to get it, and we're going to get a bum rush of 75 guys that are going to decide they're going to do it, I cannot get you those books on 2 days' notice. So you need to order them, and order them now if you're going to do it. Here's the example from St. Alphonsus. I love this story. Let us close this subject with another example in which we shall see how great is the tenderness of this good mother towards her children at death. The parish priest of a country place was assisting a certain rich man who was dying in a magnificent house and attended upon by servants, relatives, and friends. But the good priest saw also devils in the shape of dogs, wanting to carry off his soul, as they did in fact did, for he died in sin. In the meantime, a poor woman was also ill, and desiring to receive the holy sacraments, sent for the parish priest. But he, being unable to leave the rich man, whose soul stood in such need of assistance, sent her another priest, who immediately went, carrying the pyx which contained the most blessed sacrament. On his arrival, he saw neither servants, nor attendants, nor fine furniture, for the sick woman was poor, and perhaps only lying on a little straw bed. But he saw a great light in the room, and near the bed of the dying person was the Mother of God, Mary, consoling her, and with a cloth in her hand, wiping off the sweat of death. The priest, seeing Mary, feared to enter, but the Blessed Virgin made him a sign to come in. The priest entered, and Mary showed him a stool, that he might be seated and hear the confession of her servant. This he did, and after she had communicated with great devotion, she happily breathed forth her soul into the arms of Mary. I don't know where he gets these stories from, but another great one from St. Alphonsus, brother, and a great way to close our Wisdom Wednesday.
Yep, it is. It's one of those great... St. Alphonsus can scare the bejeebies out of you, and he can also edify you. Right?
Scare the what out of you?
Bejeebies. I know, that's not a bad word, is it?
Oh, I know. I thought you were going for bejeebies.
No, bejeebies. I don't use the holy name like that.
No. I meant Bee Gees.
Oh, the Bee Gees.
The Bee Gees.
I don't speak the language of Mordor and Rivendell, Mike. I just can't go for the Bee Gees, man.
Long live the King Aragorn. All right, brother, looking forward to episode 2-1 to the 7 tonight. Another Wisdom Wednesday in the books. Thank you very much. God bless you. Talk soon.
Thank you, Mike. God bless you, too, and God bless the audience.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and I'm sure they really appreciate that. Mr. Barrett, today, if you didn't know, Ricardo Barrett is in Studio B this week, which is right across from Studio D at the little mini radio palace known as the Crusade Channel.
That's right.
Here in a beautiful downtown Mandeville. Lot going on today. What you talking about here on today's... Oh, you got a guest today on the Barrett Brief.
I do. I'm going to welcome Mark Noonan back into the to the program. He is a native of Vegas, and we are going to talk all things Nevada as they are prepping for it and so forth. And I'll get his opinion on what's happened since the last time we've talked, all things impeachment and the Democratic primary and so forth.
Now, Mark has a book out. Tell the people about
Mark's
book.
He does. He has a book called Mirrors. He's writing a follow-up to it. It's a fantasy novel not in the vein of Lord of the Rings, but it follows that kind of idea of reestablishing books and literature that in that fantasy realm that's dominated by some really disgusting authors. But to reestablish that, you know, you can have good books that talk about chivalry and good virtues. And the book is fantastic. It's called Mirrors by Mark E. Newman. And you can find it where, you know, good people sell books.
You can find it wherever fine books are sold.
That's right. That is exactly what I was trying to get at.
Right.
So we have that. And then after that, we have this story from The Hill where Oregon residents are so outraged, we're talking rural ones, that they want to join Idaho. They're actually petitioning the Oregon government to go join Idaho. That would be fantastic, along with the West Virginians absorbing most of the western part of Virginia. I've been one of the only people.
Now, Oregon wants to join. Okay, so Idaho on that western border is a straight line.
Yeah, they're just
And Oregon on that part is a straight line.
Yeah, it's essentially just frustrated, non-crazy people in Portland who are so sick of the people in Portland running everything that they just want to petition to have their two counties in the state of to join Idaho, and they cite the Oregon Democratic leadership as the reason why they want to go, which would be fantastic because any kind of secession we welcome around here and so forth, and yes, that would be excellent. I've been one of the few people covering the I don't want to say demise, but the bad year of Boeing, which is now turning into the two bad years. On top of everything else, they're getting ready to get these 737 Maxes back into the air. And guess what? Now they found debris in the actual fuel tanks of the new planes that they just built. So on top of the fact that the plane can't fly straight, now there's debris in the fuel tanks. They really just need to sell every 737 they built to Michael Bay so he can just blow them up in a movie. Because at this point,
that's a great solution. The Michael Bay option.
This the Michael. He'll use them for the next 20 years, so you might as well do it. I also found this story where Burger King is doing everything they can to remove the title burger from their name, as they are now testing a French fry burger, which is nothing but French fry. Hey, it's a solution during Lent. What do y'all want? You can eat it during Lent if you're giving up meat on Friday. So
I'll eat fish.
I will eat French fry burgers. No, but it's just ridiculous. I don't know who's running Burger King right now, but
socialist.
As you can see, as they are destroying it. And actually, speaking of 737s, somebody's actually making a miniseries on how bad the Boeing 737 MAX disaster happened. I'll cover that. And Mitter Church, you and I talked about it last night, but I think we need to ring the warning bell to the rest of the world how Sony and Marvel are going to destroy our favorite superhero of all time, one of the most iconic superheroes of all time, by making him Spider Buttigieg.
Spider Buttigieg is never going to be a Jay.
That's right. That's right.
It must not happen.
It must not. Not my Spider-Man. But that's what's happening. They want to make him bisexual because they haven't ruined everybody yet, so they're going to do that.
So they're not satisfied with going She-Hulk. Now we got to go Homo Spider-Man. Spider-Homo Man.
That's right. He does whatever. I'm not going to sing that song. Anyway, in the world famous, you've got to be kidding me.
All right, so all that's coming up on the Bear Brief live here from Studio D. And then David Simpson is here with a brand new True Money show live. Aaron Barker got a brand new Break Radio. And 2 hours of Joe and Joe, or an hour of Joe and Joe, you haven't heard yet, because we didn't play it. And then Reconquest, brand new tonight. We are live all the way until 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Crusade Channel, the last live radio station standing. And if you missed it from earlier, guess what?
25% off Joseph Pierce books and the Founders Trading Post. MikeChurch.com/shop. MikeChurch.com/shop. Put two autographed Joseph Pierce books in your shopping cart. The cart automatically adjusts. Both books discounted 25%. Time to build that library up. Do it today. Don't forget consecration to St. Joseph while you're there. And order your Abbey Rose and Cappuccino Dark Rose coffee. And maybe a handmade rosary from the Little Bayou Rosary. Beeswax candles. Too much stuff to list here. Folks, we got sales. You want a sale? We got a sale. MikeChurch.com/shop. Thanks for all of you for listening today. Thanks for being with us. Stick around. Let's break some listening records today. We got great talk radio all day. And it's live. You people like live. I've seen the statistics. I know you do. Why not tell a friend or family member by sending them a gift membership or telling them they ought to get 30 days for free at crusadechannel.com/go. Thanks for being with us today. May God bless you and Mary keep you.